Blog Talk Radio.
Now, PW Torch and Spreaker bring you the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Post Show. It's time to talk this week's AEW Dynamite on TNT.
Thunder Rosa, the new AEW Women's Champion, Eric Kroll, is that going to be PWI's match of the year for 2022?
Well, it sure as heck shouldn't be. It wasn't as good as last year's Lights Out match.
I totally agree.
Which was really good, which was not my match of the year, but probably made my top 10 American matches of the year.
Yeah, I got the sense that they were told they were out of time and went to the finish rather suddenly, too, at the end.
Yeah.
Because Rose had sort of blocked and sort of not blocked the chair shot to the head, our second one in the show, which, you know, AW, please stop. But then all of a sudden it's like they just sort of act like they enter the ring and Britt Baker suddenly too staggered to stand, even though she just swung a chair and got, you know, powerbombed onto the thumbtack. So, yeah, the finish kind of came out of nowhere. Did you have that feeling, too?
Yeah, for sure. I rewound it a couple of times and put my headphones on max. When Rosa was out of the ring, sort of stumbling around after that chair shot. When Rosa was outside the ring, Aubrey Edwards said something to her. She was yelling at her. I think it was Rosa, I need you back in the ring. Yeah. I'm not 100% sure. But it was clear I knew they were running out of time because I'm watching – the clock, and they never go, despite saying they'll go past the top of the hour, they never do. And finish did come out of nowhere, marred things a little bit, you know, but overall it was an intricately booked match. Aubrey, the referee, they had a callback to some really long ago forgotten Britt Baker bit about how there was a conspiracy against her. It might have even been before she won the title. I don't even know. And it was kind of intricately booked. They didn't, it was a high spot match. It was a stunt fest, right? The in between parts that are so important that you talk about, really not a lot of that.
No, I for a while thought I was watching highlight clips of a longer match where they cut out all the transitions and selling. There was a point where Baker just popped up out of nowhere after some big spot and How did you almost get pinned and now you're just 100% fine? That stuff just takes me out of the match. It felt like they wanted to get in a bunch of big stunt spots and psychology and selling and pacing be damned. And, you know, it's why I hesitate to celebrate the aspect of some of the, you know, more hardcore stunt fest matches that are better, because I think sometimes the wrong message gets sent and wrestlers just play into that a little more than they should and lead all the others, the connective tissue that is vital to telling a compelling story. Eric, what do you think of Thunder Rosa ending the reign? Let's set aside our thoughts on the match itself and the decision to give the title Thunder Rosa. Does this feel like the culmination of a storyline, a triumphant moment, the crowning of a new champion, you know, Sting in Baltimore in 1990, that kind of transition?
No, I think the problem with this feud kind of peaked last March 17th, 2021, right? I mean, it wasn't going to be any hotter coming out of that match, and they decided they wanted to go away from the rematch. They needed to get the belt on Britt so she could have a long reign, so they decided to save this one for early in the year, quarter one of 2022. And, you know, it had peaked, you know, it was long past its peak. But that said, who else were they going to put the belt on, right? Britt's either going to have a Roman Reigns-like length of a title reign as they try and find another babyface to heat up, or you're putting the belt on Rosa and going with her for a while. And so I agree with the decision. The crowd, I thought, really added another layer to the match. They were so hot. They popped big for the hometown title change. The confetti coming down made it feel like a big deal. Rosa getting emotional. Dustin Rhodes coming out to give her a hug. And so, you know, it felt like a big deal. They can build off this. I'm not quite sure what heel is ready to take on Thunder Rosa going forward, but you can figure that out in the coming weeks.
Yes. Britt Baker, Eric, what's your assessment of her value to AEW as a top star? And to put in perspective, you know, what it means for her to lose the title, is this a to be read into in any way, or is this just sort of a necessary chapter in her run as a top heel, male or female, to have adversity and now have a babyface challenger who has the credibility of having beat her?
Yeah, I mean, you can do a rematch if you want. I did notice that when Britt came out, she did not have the boo-boo face, right? She didn't have Shawn Michaels' I lost my smile face coming out, even though she knew she was dropping the title. She reigned for 10 months. Huh. I mean, that's a long time in modern wrestling, a 10-month title reign, about maybe average in AEW. And so you can go a couple ways. You can do a rematch, although I feel like this – you know, we've had a bunch of these matches already, Rosa and Britt. So it seems like this, the cage match is the blow off, right? I think where can you go next? You can have Britt turn babyface. I don't think they'll do that right away. You have Britt and Jamie Hayter break up, and Jamie and Britt have a feud for a while. That would be Britt's next logical program because they teased tension there for quite a long time. Yeah, I mean, Britt is still a star. She is still, you know, probably the top woman in AEW in terms of, you know, in-ring charisma and the crowd being into her. And I did notice the crowd, San Antonio crowd was not split, right? They were booing Britt when she came out, which is not normally the case, right? Normally Britt gets a mix of mostly cheers and some boos as she tries to play the heel. So I did not have a problem like some did with the finish in the pay-per-view match, that New Japan House of Torture run-in fest, after I realized quickly on the pay-per-view that they were setting up Rosa for a rematch in her hometown, right? It's okay to have the babyface get screwed and then pay it off 2 weeks later. I don't have a problem with that. There's a long history of that in wrestling. You know, you're paying off. Was a little bit artificial. Could they have done something else for the pay-per-view, a tag match or something? Yeah, I suppose. But you know, it worked in the end.
I know what Tony reacted to some, I don't know if it was criticism or inquiries about whether the women's title match would headline Revolution. And he pointed out a lot of important spots he's put women's matches in. This was another one. And I don't know how many years it's been since it was a big deal when like women on Raw headlined Raw, but it was like noteworthy when it happened. And now we don't really think twice about it. It's just something that happens. Where does it jump out to you at all that, hey, there was a women's match that headlined a national cable TV show, or are we kind of past that now? And that's actually a good thing, that it's not really the everyone is thinking about as a big deal.
I think in WWE, nobody gives it a second thought because it's happened so often, right? They rely on their megastar women, you know, your Charlottes, your Beckys, your Sashas to headline shows, you know, Raw, SmackDowns and the like, and sometimes pay-per-views. In AEW, it's a bigger deal because it just doesn't happen as often. Their women's division is, you know, I don't know that I'd call it fledgling anymore, but it's still developing. It certainly is a fair assessment. They're still trying to build stars. And I think obviously you would not have wanted to main event the pay-per-view with a match that you were giving such an unsatisfying finish to, right? It was part of they were telling a story, but, you know, you send the fans home unhappy as opposed to main eventing with a match where a babyface won and you send the fans home happy. I mean, the fans in San Antonio sure as hell are going home happy tonight, right? Their hometown hero won the title, defeating the evil heel who had tortured her for so long. So, but yes, to answer your question, bigger deal in AEW doesn't happen as often.
Yeah. Now, if I didn't lead the show with comments about the women's title change, I would have led with, can AEW book that building every week until the fans tire out? Because that was a red hot crowd, sellout crowd, just absolutely. I mean, the pop for Adam Cole's music at the start of the show, the pop for Jeff Hardy, the pop for big spots in the Thunder Rosa, Britt Baker main event. Who else? There was someone else who got just a ginormous pop in this one. It was a great crowd throughout, and if you hadn't watched AEW in a while or ever before and you tuned in, you would think this is a hot pro wrestling product. And, you know, credit to AEW for that, but also credit to San Antonio for looking like they were ready for this moment.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was – they said it was sold out at the top. I think I saw a few hundred tickets left yesterday when I looked at WrestleTix. Yeah, the one of the keys to AEW getting over and building so much momentum in its first few years was the weekly just ultra-hot crowds. And last week we saw what happens when you have a dead crowd, the, you know, 2,000 people or whatever who showed up in Estero, Florida for a show that the crowd kind of brought down a little bit, I thought, at times just by sitting on their hands or not knowing how to react or whatever. But, yeah, it's that 12th man, right? If you're a football team, if you're the Kansas City Chiefs and you got that big home field advantage at Arrowhead Stadium, the crowd is AEW's advantage, and the crowd is hot because the crowd is excited to finally – I think this was their first time in San Antonio, maybe, first or second. And so the crowd was really lapping up everything they were dishing out tonight.
Yeah.
And it can paper over when, like, I didn't like the Wardlow-Scorpio Sky match that much. I thought it was just kind of there. Yeah. Kick punch for Scorpio offense. And, you know, that's a time I noticed the crowd was a little bit dead during the picture-in-picture ad break I was watching on the Fight TV feed. You know, that was the only time I wrote down, crowd seems kind of dead here the whole night. They were the MVP behind Rosa and Britt Baker, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, well, as you've noted, there's a lot more to get into on this show. So, Oz, let's formally introduce the show. And emails and more conversation about this episode of Dynamite. This is the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Post Show for Wednesday, March 16th, 2022. I'm Wade Keller, the host of the program, the editor, publisher, founder of the long-running Pro Wrestling Torch weekly newsletter and the website pwtorch.com, and the host of the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Post Shows, Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Podcasts, and several VIP exclusive shows, including the Focus on AEW and Focus on WWE series within the Wade Keller Hotline, and also the Fix with Todd Martin, Everything with Rich Fan, post pay-per-view roundtables, and more. I want to slip in a quick note that we talked at length about Scott Hall's legacy, his career on camera in front of fans, and insights into what he was like and why he was like that behind the scenes on yesterday's Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Podcast flagship edition. It was a Tuesday flagship this week with Pro Wrestling Torch columnist Rich Fan. So check that out if you haven't yet. Just search Wade Keller in your podcast app if you haven't yet. Subscribe to the Blue Logo Show and download that conversation. Also on pwtorch.com today, our main website, that's pwtorch.com. I ran part one of my 5 or 6 hour interview. I think it was actually more than 6 hours with Scott Hall from back in 2006. It was the first interview that he did longer than 10 minutes. That wasn't assigned to him by his boss running a wrestling company, WCW or WWF. And we did it in two sessions, and he really opened up. And we ran part one of that for free for everybody on pwtorch.com, and also included a link to read the dozens of installments that were spread out over months in the print copy, paper copy Pro Wrestling Torch newsletter. So you can go VIP and just dive into Scott Hall's own words for the first time ever, going in depth, walking through his career, his life, his philosophy on wrestling, his controversies, his personal challenges, and so much more. Eric, I want to get to calls. I want to talk AEW, but Scott Hall, just give me your thoughts on his death, his career, his legacy.
I mean, his death is tragic, obviously, and shows what can happen when you have demons in your life. He was here for a good time, not a long time. I think that's, isn't that the joke or what people say about that? Who were into partying and that kind of thing. Yeah. I love Scott Hall. I remember him. I'm old enough like you. I didn't see him as much in the AWA, but he was this boring stiff in the AWA. And, he was a nothing burger, the Diamond Stud in WCW, who managed by Diamond Dallas Page. And then all of a sudden he's on WWF TV, still WWF at the time, and he's Razor Ramon, and he's oozing charisma, and he's doing this sort of Latino Fonzie thing that I'm not sure he could get away with today as a white guy culturally appropriating a Latino gimmick, but he was fantastic, and he was a great worker in WWF. He was the guy who was going to do the work when they became the Outsiders, right? He was also going to eat the pins, didn't seem to bother him, and I was a big fan, and I always thought he deserved a bigger push, but I understand why Vince McMahon, when he came back, and I think he took on Austin at a WrestleMania maybe, yeah. I understand why Vince would be reluctant to put his eggs in that particular basket given Scott's lifestyle. But big fan of Scott Hall, Razor, and NWO Scott Hall.
Was there a mention other than Tony Schiavone in passing at the beginning of the cage match of Hall tonight? Did I fast forward past something or not hear a reference to him?
I did not hear any. There was one part of the show where I took a phone call during the Danielson Moxley tag match.
Yeah.
And so if it came up during that, I didn't hear it, but I don't remember it. I probably, my ears would have perked up and I would have taken a note, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. Schiavone just, you know, mentioned it in passing at the top of this, of the main event. I mean, Hall doesn't have a history with AEW or ROH for that matter, since AEW kind of owns that history and seems to be leaning into it a little bit, but a little more on him might've been cool, but no big deal. All right. So, everyone listening live on our live stream at WadeKellerPostShow.com is invited to call us. And you don't have to have a secret club pass or code or anything. It's open to everyone, and we invite first-time callers. The number to call is 347-215-8558. That's 347-215-8558. When you call, push 1 on your keypad. And that will flag you on our switchboard so that we know you want to be on the show. You can also just call that phone number and listen in and decide along the way if you want to chime in by pushing 1. You're also invited to email us, even if you don't listen to our live stream, and just download the show later when it's more convenient to listen to, as most of you do. Just email WadeKellerPodcast@pwtorch.com. WadeKellerPodcast@pwtorch.com. And, of course, be sure to check out our main website, pwtorch.com, for my live TV coverage every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday night for Raw, Dynamite, and SmackDown. Those reports also contain links to the live stream of the post shows that I host, and also my full rundown and analysis of the TV shows. And a lot more on the website. Hope you're checking it out every day. And we've got a new logo this week, so even more reason to go check it out. All right, so let's get to our calls. We're going to start with Hitton in London, Ontario, and then Larry in Beardstown, Illinois, is on deck. Hinton, thank you for calling. Good to hear from you again. What did you think of Dynamite tonight? What stood out?
Hey, wait, oh, hey, Eric.
You know
good
what?
To talk to you guys.
Hinton, I'm so sorry. It just struck me. I don't think in all, and Eric, please don't take the first thing. I don't think in all the time I've like introduced the show, I haven't introduced the co-host. I just realized I just went off and threw to you for Scott Hall. Eric Kroll, former Pro Wrestling Torch columnist, has contributed articles to pwtorch.com and is a regular voice on Wade Keller podcasts and post shows. Eric, welcome as co-host. I'm so sorry for that slight. I don't know if you're sitting there fuming or didn't notice at all. Probably didn't notice at all. But
no, I noticed. I just didn't care because I too wanted to get to the calls and not put myself over. So
I'm sorry. Now I've disrespected Hinton by interrupting him, but I did suddenly get self-conscious about that. I was like, oh, that I don't think that's ever happened. Not that I've noticed. Maybe I do it all the time and people are just resentful secretly. Anyway, thanks for understanding, Eric. Hitting back to you. Sorry.
Yeah, where's Excalibur to run down Eric's resume, right? In like a second or so. That'd be helpful, right?
Yeah.
Now. Of course. Yeah, I don't talk quite as fast, so I apologize, Eric. Yeah, as far as the women's match goes, I think you guys said what I was going to say, which is the lack of selling. Britt Baker just popping up from that landing onto all those chairs, and then falling into thumbtacks and then just running right out. I mean, I remember a similar spot that didn't involve chairs that happened to Adam Cole in NXT, and Britt was like concerned tweeting about it. And here she goes through it. She's up the next second. I'm like, okay, this. Something that I clearly thought was, you know, really painful, and now Britt's just, you know, she's getting up, and that just, and also the build to this has just been among the worst I've seen of any women's program. I mean, Sasha and Bianca last year, the build at least was just wasn't good just because of Sasha's inconsistent character presentation, but I think this is probably a bit worse. It, at least that one made sense in like the WWE universe bubble, but this one, it just... It's so scattershot. I want to actually talk about the Chris Jericho promo, and I think I read your reporting, your report on it. I know you're a fan of it, but you did mention that this works for the type of crowd that AEW attracts, and I agree with that. And I thought overall it was good in that. You know, he's introducing the faction. He's telling us who everyone is. It's not like, oh, watch BTE for the character introductions and how we met and things like that. So I think the context setting and the basics of pro wrestling were done correctly. And just being a hardcore fan, it popped me. I'm just concerned it didn't pop. You know, the sports entertainer lines in particular, I'm just concerned that wouldn't pop the extra million that AEW is trying to go for. Right, it probably works in the heat of the moment, but I think it might just harden the positions that some, you know, WWE fans who are a little more skeptical of the AEW product. It just sort of hardens their opinion, and I'm sure they're not even a fan of the sports entertainment label. But you know, when they're kind of pushed to the side and alienated, you're saying, good, we don't even want you anyway. We're not, just go be that. So I'd be okay with this if this was just for one night. But if it continues, I think it's low-hanging fruit, and they can do better. What say you?
Well, first of all, I'm going to admit a bias. I despise the term sports entertainer and sports entertainment. So anything that mocks it in the context of a heel claiming that they are a sports entertainer with pride is like, I'm just going to like it. There's no way around it. I think the term is clunky and ridiculous, and WWE calling professional athletes sports entertainers in the context of the narrative structure of the show, when they're fighters, they're pro wrestlers, they're competitors, they're athletes, and you're saying they're entertainers, it's so annoying and clunky. So I think it's, like, to use Chris Jericho's word, genius, to go for heel heat as a heel, as a wrestler who fans are going to have a tendency to want to cheer because they love Jericho, they love his song, they're cheering him until that moment. And to then say, and I'm a sports entertainer, and have Danny Garcia, who is the opposite of a sports entertainer, in the way that term means anything anyway. He's this just tightly wound, badass, you know, young wrestler. And for him to just embrace that term, I really liked. And I think if Jericho's trying to get booed, which I think heels, by the way, ought to try to be booed, like that should be their goal, not to get pops in the ring entrances or pops for their signature moves or anything like that. This was, I thought, a really cool reinvention. It had some meta aspects that I didn't mind, such as him saying, I've reinvented myself again, because I think, well, I'm generally against meta stuff, it's nuanced. I'm against it if it doesn't have a foundation in a storyline that builds heat and builds anticipation for wanting to see somebody beat somebody else up. In this case, him bragging about reinventing himself in the context of christening himself a sports entertainer and saying that's superior to everybody else around here or pro wrestlers is also pure storyline. It works, absolutely works on multiple levels. So I'm on board with it. I can be talked out of it with a persuasive argument, or if it goes the wrong direction quickly, because I could imagine it them, you know, Jericho laying into it too thick, and that just it sort of being a one note thing. But as a launching point for the new faction, it was among the things I liked about that segment. Eric, how about you?
I think on balance, I'm on Team Hinton here. The promo, it's a cliche WWE style promo to say I turned heel because the fans disrespected me. The fans didn't appreciate me, right? I mean, that every heel turn, that Edge's heel turn they just did, Becky Lynch's sort of failed heel turn. But I have a question. So it's very inside the sports entertainer thing.
Is it?
At least, well, that's my question.
Yeah.
So in 20 years ago, I don't know, in the middle of the Monday Night Wars, I don't know, there wasn't a sports entertainer heel promo on WCW to compare it to, but, you know, the AEW crowd is certainly going to lap this up, right? Making fun of WWE and their goofy terms and goofy names and sports entertainment and weird vocabulary. In that way, I think Jericho's filling in the gap left by Cody, who always wanted to take shots at WWE. But do the fans who aren't the AEW hardcore fans know the distinction of what a sports entertainer is versus a pro wrestler and why people would be booing that? Or are the hardcore fans on both sides the only fans that are even left in the year 2022? So there's not much of a new audience. It's just everybody knows, so it's okay. I mean, I guess the answer to that question will help me determine kind of where I come down on it.
I think if you tuned into pro wrestling for the first time ever and heard the term and saw a group of wrestlers standing in the ring calling themselves sports entertainers, that's instant heel heat. You don't need any context. It's a ridiculous two words paired together to describe what these athletes are doing in simulated fights on television. So I don't think you need to have insider knowledge to find it abrasive and obnoxious and like this sort of self-indulgent patting ourselves on the back for calling ourselves something that is supposed to be different and better than a pro wrestler. So I just think it sort of works on an instinctual guttural level. Like you're just, your gut reaction to that term is, ugh. So I think there's a whole spectrum of responses to it. I think it's not an insider term because we had, you know, JBL going, if you built a sports entertainer from the ground up, you'd have Randy Orton. And it's just like gag reflex. And you had, you know, wrestlers being mandated to call themselves sports entertainers as a way to hype a fight. Like, I'm an entertainer with the vague term sports in front of it that's supposed to get you excited about me being a badass who's trying to convince you I'm about to go into a fight for a title that matters. So, like I said, I am biased in favor of this because it is openly mocking something WWE does. What's interesting about this is, does Jericho do this if his contract is up? is he doing this and thinking Vince McMahon will kind of find it funny? Like, I'm not saying it burns a bridge because maybe Jericho thinks Vince won't get it or won't see it for what it is, but this did kind of come across like, I don't ever plan to go there again because I'm making fun of something that is precious to Vince McMahon, which is the term he used to try to differentiate himself from pro wrestling, even though, you know, he built a network around acquiring a bunch of pro wrestling tape libraries and has filled his roster full of people who were pro wrestlers on the pro wrestling indie circuit, but acted like what once they arrived on his stage, it was somehow something entirely different, which was just a PR line to feed to advertising agencies and networks, which they bought hook, line, and sinker at times. But to muddy up the fan experience by bringing that term outside of pitch meetings and onto television is where it crossed the line for me. So I'm kind of curious about that, Eric. How do you think Vince would interpret this, or do you think Jericho has thought of that or cares?
Yeah, I mean, that occurred to me, too. I think Jericho is signed through next year, maybe. I think it was he had a four-year deal, maybe,
yeah.
Or a three-year with an option.
Yeah.
That's been exercised. So, business is business. If Vince thinks he could make money with Jericho, or alternately Vince wants to Jericho to pay a price – and Vince is willing to give him several million dollars and just job him out at the end of his career. I mean, either way for Vince, I suppose that works, right? He's either stealing AEW's first champion and bringing a guy home, or he's jobbing him out and getting his revenge. I mean, I thought Jericho was angling to come back to WWE, and I thought his contract might have been up sooner when he appeared on Stone Cold Steve Austin's the sessions on WWE or Peacock, maybe, because he certainly seemed to be trying to put his foot back in the WWE door, but this is would seem to be the opposite of that.
Yeah, and he signed either had a rollover or signed an extension. I think he signed a two-year extension last month. So he's around for all of this year, all of next year. He'll be 53 or 54 then. So, you know, he might just be thinking, well, it'll be a distant memory by then. And if this keeps me over, with audiences, he is going to be it won't matter. You know, like that's where the value is just staying relevant and reinventing himself. He is probably thinking 2 years from now or a year and a half from now, if he enters, you know, a phase where he's thinking about going back to WWE for a final stanza, who knows where the wrestling world is, who knows where the world is at that point. That's far enough down the road. I don't think he needs to be too concerned. Let me throw back to Hinton here for any follow-up on what Eric and I had to say, or if you want to switch topics, you certainly can.
Yeah, I have a few points. So I have someone who – I know someone who watches AEW and is actually a fairly new wrestling fan who I ask, and she's not really exposed to the WWE marketing machine quite as much. She'll catch some of the big shows. But, you know, she had a kind of a hard time reconciling this promo. She's like, well, Boaster is probably a new thing that he made up. So
and it works on that level, too, because it's such a gag-inducing term if you've never heard it before and you just hear it. It just sounds like an off-key piano trying to say, you know, play notes. So even if you don't know what it is, you don't need to know what it is. It's obnoxious.
Yeah, she's more like, yeah, I'm not sure what her actual reaction would have been if she was in the crowd. It just seemed like she wouldn't have brought that up to me. She would have just, you know, as I asked her, she's just more amused by it rather than, you know, like us right now. Like, I'm with you. I'm, like, really cheering it. I'm like, yeah, you know what, make fun of it. But, like, she's just kind of chill about it. But that's just one anecdote. Yeah. I'm sure people will write in saying, oh, well, I know someone who, you know, knew and loved it. The second point is, you know, how does a babyface sort of make a case, like, you know, against them, saying, oh, we're pro wrestlers? Because you look at AEW, you got Danhausen, you got Orange Cassidy, you got Pretty Peter Avalon. I mean, there was a dance-off, there was a presidential, like, you know, entrance. There's a whole host of things AEW has done, which is way more sports entertainment-y than WWE. It's just, you know, they just do that stuff, in my opinion, a little better than WWE tends to do. So I'm not really sure
if
babyface has come.
Let me clarify, too. Sports entertainment isn't actually a thing. It's a term. Pro wrestling has – every promoter has always had things that were about promoting a fight with serious fighters and comedy. Bobby Heenan wasn't a sports entertainer because he was telling jokes and taking wild and crazy bumps and wearing a weasel suit when he lost to Greg Gagne. He was a pro wrestler who was a pro wrestling manager, the best of all time, and he was part of a company that proudly proclaimed themselves within the narrative presentation of their product – pro wrestling with pro wrestlers. It didn't mean the fights had to be real. It meant we're simulating something that doesn't exist in the real world, but the closest thing to it is MMA, where people are professionally wrestling each other for prizes. They're prize fighters, as Kevin Owens would say. Sports entertainment isn't actually a category of anything. So the fact that there's a librarian, that's not sports entertainment. That's part of pro wrestling. You can like it or not like it, but it's not like there's a thing that actually falls under a sports entertainment, the auspices of that term. It's just a term Vince McMahon applies to everything that he does. He doesn't have the sports entertainment division of his booking. That's the mid and undercard, and then the main eventers are pro wrestlers. Everything, the great main events that are competitive and athletic and 4 or 5-star matches, those are also sports entertainment. That's what Vince McMahon has pasted over the word pro wrestling to try to pretend he's something that he's not in order to market himself to corporate executives and advertisers who shunned pro wrestling. It was a strategy behind the scenes that should have stayed behind the scenes. So I always cringe when people go, well, AEW has less sports entertainment in their booking or they have too much sports entertainment. I contend, and I will be steadfast in it, that sports entertainment is not a thing. It's not a category of presentation of a pro wrestling product. It is a stupid term Vince McMahon has forced onto the airways that he should never have. So anyway, I have to interject that hit.
No, I completely agree with you, and I totally buy all those points. I'm just sort of using it in the colloquial way that I've heard most fans that I've interacted with use it, which is in association with the worst qualities of what WWE puts forth, which just so happens to be, you know, Bray Wyatt and all the comedy stuff.
Point taken. And I think it is, I interject not because I didn't know you were using it in a colloquial way, but to push back on it, it's sort of like people who say try and do when they mean try to do, even though try and do makes no sense. It's either redundant or contradictory, but the dictionary will accept it if people say it wrong long enough. And I'm sort of fighting that and saying, no, we're not, let's not make that a thing. that's just a term Vince McMahon pasted over pro wrestling to try to hide what he's doing. So I am pushing back against it, but I do understand the spirit in which you said it.
Perfect. That's all I wanted to talk about today, actually. Don't have really any other points. I thought it was a pretty good show. Hope you guys have a good post-show. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks. Yep, cool. Appreciate it, him. All right. Let's go to Larry, as promised. By the way, you can get in line on the phone banks. On the phone lines, 347-215-8558. We welcome pro wrestling fans and sports entertainment fans, but just, you know, be ready to be yelled at. Larry, welcome.
Hey, yo. Just a
well
special shout-out there to the late Starship Coyote.
There you go. Yep.
Yeah.
I
followed. That was actually the first time I saw Scott Hall was real early on in the days of WTBS's change to Crockett's promotion and a little bit of Central States that he and Dan Spivey were in briefly. And as strange as this might sound to you guys, I think when he early in his career. And in his AWA days, he was actually bigger,
freaking
huge compared to, you know, his WWE run as Razor Ramon. And he wasn't exactly a small guy there.
Yeah,
AWA,
no, good point.
I think
he was Jack.
Even with a plain big Scott Hall, you know, they weren't lying.
No.
But I wanted to first, thanks for the compliment on the hey yo thing. I wanted to try and make it sound as close to Razor as I could. And I wanted to say that I watched the AEW show, and overall I liked it. What I really liked was, like you had said, except for one little flash or little moment, the crowd was really up for the show. And it's part of the reason, you know, that, to me, makes a good wrestling show when the crowd, you're not pumping in a ton of crowd noise, and when they act like they're happy to be there and they're having fun, and they at least, you know, are there to give things a chance and enjoy the show instead of just immediately, well, we're going to come in here and just, you know, crap on the product and hijack the show like that's happened a few times on Raw shows. And I got to guess.
Larry, it's an example of goodwill. I mean, you know, AEW hasn't been perfect, but they have goodwill with their fans, and they're excited to experience this brand of pro wrestling in person. And when they get a chance to do that, generally, we've seen excited crowds. This is in the top, you know, top 15% of crowds that AEW has had, I would estimate. But in general, you know, when you seem to embrace and love what you are and what you do, and you have an owner who is as big of a fan as anybody of, you know, the product, I mean, you're going to have fans who pick up on that and show enthusiasm for it. So, yeah, it's fun to see that manifest with the type of reaction we had tonight.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. I watched the whole show. You know, I watched the crowd was really into the Hardys. They were mostly into, I think, the Jericho Appreciation Society thing, and I think, you know, sports entertainer has been bandied about enough over the years, and the WWE has, you know, pushed that word onto the public enough where I don't think it's quite as foreign to fans that aren't smart or hardcore. Some people might think it is, because hasn't the WWE been calling their guys or referring to themselves as sports entertainment since like the 80s?
Yeah. It was I don't know, Eric, do you know, was it like 86 or 85-ish when Vince started using that term again? It was created to tell network execs and advertisers and licensing partners were different than those, as Vince would say, smoke-filled arenas with those fake wrestlers. He wanted to say we're something different. He never was. There were always promoters who promoted wrestling in different ways, and they had different styles. But, I mean, there's some stuff Jerry Lawler booked in Memphis that would make – you know, a lot of stuff that Superman has been criticized for seems serious and realistic. You know, so, I mean, it's just the idea that he invented a way to not take wrestling as seriously as he imagined other territorial promoters were doing. No, I mean, it was a marketing gimmick to become accepted in, you know, New York, high society circles. And it, yeah, but it has been around a very long time. Eric, can you pinpoint when you first heard it?
I mean, so there's like two phases of this. There's the phase you point out where at first Vince McMahon is ashamed to be the guy at the rich person's cocktail party who's in the wrestling business,
yep,
as he mocks it. And then there's the sort of it's not just sports entertainer. It's the whole goofy vocabulary that they use. And I think the goofy vocabulary is I don't recall that being taking part, being so dominant in like the Monday Night Wars. Right. That's a post Monday Night War thing where a title opportunity and you can't say belt, you know, the 50 different rules that you can't.
It's a rivalry, not a feud.
Yeah, all of that stuff. I mean, that's to me is sports entertainer is just the symbol, the easily grasped symbol for that. But it's the whole thing that drives people up the wall, I think.
Yeah.
It's just so goofy, and it's not how normal people speak, right? It's not how wrestling fans speak, right? I mean, I don't even think wrestling fans are saying, I'm going to the sports entertainment show tonight. I'm going to wrestling, right? I mean, despite 20, 25 years of Vince McMahon trying to shove it down everybody's throats. So it's always been obnoxious.
Larry, back to you.
Well, and I want to admit, it's ironic you brought up Jerry Lawler's Memphis that when I watched the main event, as soon as they talked about Baker not coming out with a hater or a rebel, my first thought was 1987 hair versus hair cage match, Idol and Lawler, Tommy Rich comes out from under the ring. I thought, okay, that's what they're going to do. They're going to have both of them come out from under the ring. And when Paul Turner went down, I was like, okay, here it comes. Oh, and then Audrey Edwards comes running in. It's like, okay, it's not going to happen now. It might happen in a little bit. But then Thunder Rosa hit the driver on Baker and pinned her. And that place, you could tell it went totally bananas. And I was like, it's going to be interesting seeing Rosa as the champion, kind of wondering, you know, where it'll go from here, which is kind of a good thing. And I was pleasantly surprised that I thought, okay, I think I got this figured out. And then I was completely wrong on it. And I was like, hey, every now and then this whole pro wrestling thing still is kind of cool. But, again, overall, I like the show. And wanted to ask you guys
when Britt Baker pulled the bag. Oh, Larry,
what's that?
Can you hear me? I think our internet glitched briefly.
Yes.
Can you hear me?
It happens.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. Let me insert a quick anecdote. When Britt Baker pulled the bag of thumbtacks out from under the ring, and Jim Ross was like, you know, what in God's name is a bag of thumbtacks? Why does that need to be under the ring? He's like just all worked up about it. And because it's like, you know, and he's like conveniently, or a few minutes earlier, he goes, conveniently, there's all these chairs under the ring. And so, you know, Ross is, you know, kind of in a mode of picking apart the implausibilities and the odd conveniences of all the apparatus under the ring. And Giovanni just, you know, astutely, I don't know if Tony Khan fed him the line or not. Either way, it works. Tony's like, I think maybe Jamie Hayter or Rebel maybe put it under there before the match, Jim. And Jim's like, oh, yeah. Okay, that could make sense. So I like that there was, like, a plausible explanation for something. But in Ross earlier, he was like, it's a six-man tag match or a trios match, if you insist, or whatever. You know, the preciousness of calling a six-man tag a trios match. And Jim Ross, I'm on Team Ross on this one, mocking it pretty regularly. So anyway, I enjoyed some of Jim Ross's tonight, even if he did get caught a little bit on the bag attacks. Eric, do you want to respond to anything Larry brought up, and then I'll throw it back to Larry.
Did you like it when JR talked about the two women wrestlers playing with Barbie dolls when they were young? In the day, that's an oof for me. It's typical JR retrograde sexism and, you know, defining gender roles very rigidly.
He's just from the Mad Men era, and it just, you know, that's his generation, and it's not an excuse. I'm just explaining. You know,
I know.
That's the way his generation talks. That's the way his generation still talks to each other in a lot of places. But, yeah, it'd be nice to, you know, not have that stuff seem like, I don't know, it shouldn't be slipping out. and slipping out or boldly being stated repeatedly week after week is maybe a better way to put it. There's some groan-inducing moments, you know. And sometimes it seems like he's kind of self-aware and we don't hear about Jezebel as often. And then it'll kind of, you know, slip back in.
And I too assumed that when Paul Turner went down and took the bump, that that the two henchwomen were coming out, and Rebel and Jamie Hayter, and it didn't happen. And I kept sometimes, you know, I know from I think we were at Revolution. Full Gear pay-per-view in Minneapolis. And I think at the end of that, at some point in the Hangman, Kenny Omega title match, they had the camera, you know, the rolling camera go up the rampway to start shooting the Young Bucks when they came out. And so I, you know, it stuck in my mind, cause I'm like, oh, could you telegraph that the Young Bucks are coming out any more than you're doing right now? Now you would not know that if you were on
fake and scripted everything is.
Yeah, and it took me out of the moment, and you know, if you were watching it on TV, which you know 99% of the audience was, you wouldn't have seen that. But I saw it. I'm like, oh, come on, guys! So I was watching out of the corner of my eye. I'm like, when they went to a wide shot, I'm like, is the camera guy going up with the other guy who's holding the you know the wire, the cord, so that these two are coming in, and they never did. And so it was, I guess, the match itself was. Charitably, you could say it was intricately booked. If you're a critic, you might call it overbooked a little bit. But they did not do, you know, it was clean, you know, a clean finish, relatively speaking. They could have cut something to give them a few more minutes so that they didn't have to rush the ending.
Yeah, that just shouldn't happen. It happens. It shouldn't. And there should be an assessment of how did we let that happen. And correct course, it's not the end of the world, but it's not something you want to brush off as, well, it happens sometimes. Oh, well, you want to figure out how do we try to prevent that from happening in the future. The worst, by the way, worse than the camera guy going for something that is supposedly not foreseeable in the narrative structure storyline context is when wrestlers are going to brawl in the crowd and there's a handheld cameraman stationed there already waiting for them. On this impromptu, who could have seen it coming brawl in the crowd? And the worst is when they brawl up to the concourse and security has already cordoned off the fans and they're all leaning back, excited to see what's about to happen in the concourse because they know something's going to happen because they just were told you don't get to come into this zone, don't cross this barricade or this line. And then there's the phony merch table set up on an old style desk that is not what merch stands look like anymore. WWE's been better about that lately. But yeah, it's like if I'm a promoter, I risk a fan getting hurt in a lawsuit to not have it look so freaking phony when everyone's already pushed aside. I would like, you know, you can hire extras and have security yelling at fans, watch out, back up, as the wrestlers, you know, brawl into the concourse and create kind of a scene as long as you don't have a bunch of people hamming it up and overacting. There's ways around it. But anyway, that's high on my pet peeve list. Larry, back to you.
I hadn't thought of it quite like that before with the camera in the crowd, but when you mention it like that, it does make a lot of sense. And I want to maybe comment and ask you guys, since Khan, you know, Tony Khan's bought ROH, and ROH has the kind of their return show. This was a Supercard of Honor down in Texas, Dallas, I think. And do you think they should spend some time over the next couple of weeks maybe mentioning it? Because I think Swerve is supposed to be on the card. If you were Khan or if you were in AEW management, because you own ROH now, would you, like, maybe a week before the show somehow bring it up? Hey, you know, have Tony Khan come out and talk about it. ROH is back, Supercard of Honor, and we're going to have this guy and this guy and this guy and talk about it? Or do you think it would be a waste of TV time?
I am not sure how I feel about that particular question, because I still don't have a good feeling, a good overall vibe of where Tony sees the ROH brand going, how prominent he wants it to be. Is it going to be like NXT when it was on local television in Florida? And there was, you know, the circuit of small shows they ran, and if you sought out tapes or DVDs, I should say, you could get them. But it was sort of like under the radar, or when they were on the network, or when they're on USA Network. Like, at what level does he want it? Or is he going to run it ostensibly as, like, this equal brand so that he can fantasy book an invasion storyline at some point and do it better than or replicate the aspects of that past invasion angles he likes. Tony, Eric, is in a lot of ways, you know, living out you know, pro wrestling fantasy, pro wrestling promoter Booker Fantasy Camp with a lot of things that he does that he's nostalgic for. Every Booker probably has done this, you know, in their own way. When they got the book, they thought back about their childhood and what they liked and tried to modernize and replicate. So I could see that happening. So I don't have a strong opinion on how hard they should publicize ROH, because it still isn't clear to me how far he's going to go and how realistic his goals are when it comes to that. Eric, your assessment or your take on that?
I think I agree. It depends on what his creative vision is going to be for ROH. I mean, he certainly does not have the pressure of, I got to make this pay-per-view on April 1st blockbuster, and I got to start getting some of the money back. He doesn't have that financial pressure. And it sure seemed like parts of the deal haven't closed, or, you know, the post pay-per-view press conference, he was deliberately vague and was basically like, there's still too many moving parts to this. And so he either knows and can't say, or he just rushed to buy this thing and he's got to figure it out. But what is true is, as far as I know, he doesn't have a TV outlet for ROH to promote. I mean, I guess they're still on Sinclair through the pay-per-view, I guess. And so you can promote it that way. I mean, there is AEW Dynamite is already in Rampage are already so overpacked. It's like he is just, every segment is stuffed to the gills with a bunch of wrestlers, matches, people get interrupted, angles, interviews to set up more matches. If he wanted to, this is a good time period for AEW to do it, because there's 4 more Dynamites before Battle of the Belts, and 10 more, I think, before the Double or Nothing pay-per-view. So he's got time, right? He can afford, but I think on balance, they're so crazed about not having people flip the channel that you might get a mention of it. Maybe you plug their YouTube channel of, you know, the road to the ROH pay-per-view. But until they settle on what it is they're going to do here and they can sort of make that public, next pay-per-view is just sort of an inconvenience for AEW at this point, I think. They probably would rather have a couple months to figure this out.
Yeah. Larry, anything else for us before I move on?
Well, I wanted to, you know, since we brought up the acquisition, I don't think some of the promotion acquisitions that I remember turned out real well. I'm old enough to remember when Jim Crockett Promotions bought out Florida and the UWF and Central States and how those turned out. And I almost thought a little bit about those things, you know, with, Tony Khan and AEW and Ring of Honor. And, yeah, you make a great point that no one's real sure where they're going with this. Could it be just they'll run it as like a kind of a developmental? Will they run it as trying to be relatively equal to AEW? Will he just run some shows and then, you know, give up on it and just, you know, have the rights to the footage and the merchandise and things like that? It's definitely an interesting time to be a wrestling fan. You know, say what you will about some of the product in some areas. You know, independent wrestling's made a tremendous comeback over the last year or two. We've got a couple of promotions local to where I am, and WWE's coming to a Springfield, which is about 50 miles from me. They're coming Saturday night to the BOS Center, and looks like ticket sales have been fairly good for the show, and that's kind of a good thing. The more people that are interested in wrestling, the more people go into independent shows, you know. I think the better it is for the product. It's more jobs for people that want to be wrestlers or work in the industry.
Yeah, I am... As you're talking, I'm just kind of thinking, you know, where does ROH as a brand fall with the AEW audience, which, you know, I think people who know ROH are assuming AEW fans are going to know everything about ROH. And I a lot of them do, obviously. I don't know what degree they do, but even if they do, I don't know how interested they're going to be in a storyline that involves some sort of group of wrestlers representing ROH invading AEW or title versus title matches compared to the wonderful stories and wonderful matches that AEW with their deep roster could just be telling coherently and in an intra-squad type way within the AEW Dynamite Rampage universe. And, you know, do you distract yourself with a concept that actually is displacing something better? Ricky Starks' character is based now on, you know, you're bringing in these, you know, acts that were discarded for various reasons, some justified, some not, by WWE, and they're displacing people like him and Powerhouse Hobbs from the spotlight that they think they should have, or the place that they think they're going to, that they're going to knock them out of. And, you know, so my mind goes there too. It's like, oh, it's exciting to acquire the ROH library, but is that ultimately the best story to tell? Or is this more, I always wanted to do an invasion storyline or a rival promotion storyline. This is the best chance I get, so I'm going to do it. And he loses sight of just keeping things a little simpler and within the brand. Eric, how do you feel about that? As far as the, I mean, you and I haven't talked about this since the news, and it's not as tied to Dynamite as I'd like here on the post show, but just what is your take on the ROH, the potential of that brand?
I mean, it's kind of a dead brand. It mostly died when the, you know, Cody and the Bucks and Hangman and left, and ROH decided to play it conservatively and didn't make a bid to keep them. And then ROH, you know, still had their Madison Square Garden show that they'd sold out on the, you know, the fans thinking Kenny Omega and the Bucks and Cody were going to be there. And so, you know, I mean, it's been lame since then, right? I mean, I know people say that some of the pay-per-views have been well-worked, but it's just, you know, I had it in my rotation when the Elite was on there, and then a few months in, I just dropped it because it was so, like, there's so many hours of wrestling on TV, it's so boring. To me, if you wanted to do a hot shot invasion angle, you'd have to put some AEW guys on Team ROH, and they'd have to be the leaders, I think, right? I believe they're not going to bring the Briscoes in. I think I read somewhere recently that a Time Warner exec was like, no, the anti-gay comments that the Briscoes made back in the day, we don't want them. We don't want the heat. You'd almost have to put Bryan Danielson, CM Punk, and possibly the Bucks to lead that team, right? Then that to me doesn't make a lot of sense. I suppose there's probably ways you could write that. I don't see a pathway for it. Doesn't mean there isn't a pathway to it, but, you know, I mean, right, you know, is that what they're saving Brian Cage for? His contract renewed and his return. I don't know that Brian Cage was a ROH guy, but stick him in with that crew. There's not enough star power. It's like, what, Jay Lethal could do that. You could bring in Jonathan Gresham, but those wrestlers would pale in, you know, charisma comparison and being perceived by AEW fans as stars. And I don't know that on itself, Team ROH versus Team AEW, is all that compelling.
Yeah. All right, cool. Larry, I appreciate the call.
Hey, thanks, guys. Looking forward to hearing what the rest of the callers tonight think.
I appreciate it. Thank you. Thanks for calling in. Good to hear a voice who remembers the Florida acquisition by Jim Crockett Promotions and the Mid-South UWF acquisition. All right, we'll move on to Ryan in Cumberland, Maryland. Ryan, welcome. What stood out on Dynamite for you tonight?
I have a question about the steel cage match. Kenny Schiavone said something that sort of threw me off. He said something about winning a match by countout in a steel cage match, and that just really confused me when he made that comment. AEW has some really crazy rules compared to WWE when it comes to cage matches, or did he just screw up?
I didn't catch that. I think Tony screwed up. I mean, if Tony said there would be a count out, Eric, do you remember that? Was there any context that would make sense?
So near the beginning of it, like right away at the start of the match, Britt hears the crowd is all fired up and is in Rosa's corner, and Rosa hits her, you know, or whatever, does a move on her. And then Britt does the cowardly heel thing if she's trying to curl out of the cage. And I thought, wait a second, I don't, like in WWE, I know you can crawl out of the cage to win the match, right? Yeah, and I thought, is that what's going on here? I don't think so. And then somebody said you win a match in AEW, you win by pinfall or submission in a cage. And Tony Giovanni did say the count out thing. I don't know that they've ever explained it, right? It's like in NFL overtime, the rules are so convoluted, they have to put up the graphic explaining what happens. The first team gets a field goal, but not a touchdown, or doesn't score. Yeah, a little bit of clarification would be nice. Tony Schiavone seems to only talk in two ways on Dynamite. One, when JR says something and he's the amen corner for JR. Oh, good point, Jim. Or two, when Tony Khan whispers something in his ear. So it would seem weird. The whole point of a cage is that there is no count out. But
yeah.
What would have happened if that's not a way to win, like in WWE, what would have happened if Britt just took a powder, hypothetically? Does she get counted out?
If I'm a commentator and I'm if that's presented to me without any planning ahead of time, I'd say that that Britt Baker is a champion who's defending her title in a cage because it's to prevent her from getting counted out. So if she escapes the cage, the match will be paused and she will be redeposited in that cage. And if she tries to escape again, she'll be stripped of the championship. That's something short of a count out. And then I would say don't revisit it because it does kind of complicate matters in a way that doesn't fit the story that you're trying to tell, which is the cage is brutal and it's locked the heel inside. So they can't get out. Like the whole point, I mean, Eric, you and I grew up, the cage was there to keep a heel in the ring from escaping. So when the opening note is a WWE gimmick that doesn't apply to AEW rules, I question the wisdom of Britt and Thunder and the producer for the match deciding that would be a good opening scene without everyone being on the same page on commentary explaining what would happen if she did leap over the cage. Jim Ross could just go, you know what happens if she runs out of the building? Thunder Rosa is going to go out the door and chase her down and drag her back into the ring by the hair. And then I just leave it there. And then I maybe talk to the wrestlers afterwards and go, this isn't WWE. Heels don't try to escape the cage. Because our storyline is the cage keeps you, you know, locked up so you can't get away. I mean, it's a quick little spot in a match. It's not a big deal, but yeah, Eric.
I don't blame the wrestlers. I blame the commentators, right? Because the heel being chicken shit is a time-honored trope, especially in a cage match, right? Where they finally are going to get their just desserts and get what's coming to them. And that's a perfectly acceptable spot. But your point of the commentators needing to be clued in, smartened up is well taken.
And I guess too, if you're in 2022, if you're a heel and you're trying to get out of the cage, you want to think the next step, which is what do I want fans to think happens if I do escape? And if there's not a good answer for it, maybe don't do the spot or maybe consult Tony and the announcers and go, I'm going to try to get out of the cage. And the announcers know how to cover for this because fans are going to wonder what happens if I were to escape. I don't think they're, thinking that hard about things, and they probably don't think it's worth the effort to think that hard about things. But heck, I mean, Ryan's bringing it up and it was awkward on commentary. So, I'm a straighten your tie, detail oriented person when it comes to this stuff. I am an advocate for an actual rule book being published on AllElite Wrestling.com on AEW's website, AEWWrestling.com, whatever it is. And just I think they should get together and write a damn rule book and reference it and have all the producers actually memorize what it is and the announcers know what it is and the wrestlers know what the rules are so that we have a structure to the stories we tell. That's how much of a stickler I am for this stuff. But, when we look at the tag rules in Young Bucks matches and Tony Khan embracing it and thinking that stuff isn't important, he is in that way of a different philosophy than me. Go ahead, Ryan. What else have you got for us?
Okay. Second question I have is on Paige Van Zandt. Is there any possibility that she's like King Mo from Impact Wrestling and never actually wrestles? Because Impact did that gimmick where they'd always say they signed an MMA guy, but then they would never wrestle. So I'm just wondering if AEW is just doing this as a publicity stunt and not going to pull it, have her actually wrestle.
I think she's going to wrestle. What do you think, Eric?
Oh, yeah, for sure. Clearly they had I was in Chicago for Dynamite when they had that horrible Brit, Brandy Rhodes, Dean Lambert exchange that was just horrible, just terrible. Like,
I love that that's Brandy's happened. Last national television appearance, perhaps ever.
Yeah, and well, Paige Van Zandt comes. Yeah, Paige Van Zandt came out, and attacked Brandy, and that was clearly supposed to set up, a couples tag team match or Paige with All Ego or Scorpio Sky. And now I thought last week they'd move to Sammy and Conti versus Paige Van Zandt. And I don't think it's her husband, even though he was at ringside tonight, because you need somebody on the heel team who actually knows how to wrestle and can wrestle the bulk of the match, right? But that's, I guess you can rush Paige VanZant into the ring against Conti and Sammy and hide it in a mixed tag, and then she can go learn to wrestle. I mean, for all I know, she's been working with Dustin Rhodes or QT Marshall at their training schools learning how to wrestle, right? I mean, entirely possible. I guess we'll see how it plays out.
Ren, what else?
My final question is on Jade and the green hair. Is that a tribute to the She-Hulk? Because I know they're having a new show on Disney Plus that's coming out this year. So in there, she was just trying to be like a cosplay, you know, character of that, or is it something else, do you think?
Eric?
On a couple of couple weeks ago, when she debuted the green hair, her costume was, to me, it looked like the old, like either the Jim Carrey Riddler or the 60s Batman TV show Riddler, and instead of the question marks, it had dollar signs all over it. So I think it was it started as a a money thing, green money, and that kind of thing, just based on the first outfit she was wearing.
Yeah.
And tonight, her promo was something that could be cut. It wasn't long, but there was no point to it. She didn't get her next opponent, as far as I can remember. And nobody came and answered an open challenge for Rampage this week. So there was no point in that other than just keeping Jade on TV every week, top of mind.
And I actually like that. I think it's one of the things AEW has done well is, there's a lot of wrestlers who just disappear weeks at a time, especially in the women's division, and they just make sure Jade's on TV every week. They want her to become a household name among Dynamite viewers. They don't want people to forget about her. And I like the Sterling Cargill chemistry, and I like backstage interviews that aren't part of a match that's on this show that's just establishing a character. And, you know, Sterling said, who's ready to be lucky number 30? So they're underlining her streak, and she does her bitch show catchphrase. And it just is kind of planting that seed for something that's coming later that won't feel so jarringly sudden when it happens, because they're talking about it even on the week it's not happening.
In the build to Wardlow and Scorpio Sky, watch the Road to and the Tony Schiavone Control Center on YouTube.
Yeah.
Ethan Page was emphasizing heavily Scorpio Sky's undefeated streak. And I'm like, what?
What streak?
He won one match on Dynamite, right, and a bunch on Dark. There's that on that level, it doesn't work. But then on the other level, only one wrestler gets a streak gimmick at a time, please, right? that's what made Goldberg so, you know, part of what made Goldberg so effective back in the day. And Jade needs it a hell of a lot more than Scorpio Sky does to get over, because he can actually wrestle pretty well.
What was I going to say about the streak? And I totally forgot. Oh, well. It'll come to me at an inconvenient time. It'll interrupt someone. Ryan, thanks for the call, as always.
Okay, thanks for taking the call.
Sure thing, yep. That's going to drive me nuts. All right, we'll go to Brian in Boston next. Brian, thanks for calling. What's on your mind about Dynamite tonight?
How are you guys doing tonight?
Good.
Surprised I was the next in line. Usually takes a few callers, but I'll take it. Anyway.
You just made all the people I leapfrog feel bad, Brian. Bad form. It's our secret.
Well, they're not as good as I am when it comes to analyzing women's wrestling, but anyway. I thought the show was really good tonight. The opening was really good with Red Dragon and Cole versus the tag champs, Jurassic Express and Adam Page, two Adams again. That was a really nice opener, and I actually really enjoyed the Wheeler Yuta thing, kind of teasing joining with Regal, Danielson, and Moxley. It's, you know, it'd be nice to see him getting away from the Pudding Gang, as it's sometimes called, because that, anyway. But
well,
I,
Brian, let me pause you for a sec because I don't want to not talk about that. Eric, if someone said I missed Dynamite tonight, what's going on with Regal, Moxley, and Danielson? How would you, you know, just kind of explain the Reader's Digest, the bullet point key of what they and AEW are going for with that act right now?
I can't tell if they're supposed to be faces or heels. I think they're supposed to be heels because they're kind of jerky to people. And they beat people up. At the end, the Udities there, Regal got such a huge babyface pop last week when he went way over on his time. And, you know, so it's hard to tell. Like, it's still in development. And I guess we'll find out when they have their first real feud against, a more high-profile team. But wrestling against – I can't remember who they wrestled last week. But, you know, this week it's Yuta and Chucky T who are babyfaces, right? And
right,
so
totally.
You would think they're heels. And Regal slapping Yuta and saying, maybe another day. And Yuta kind of nodding his head. You know, it just sets the stage for something down the road. Now, if they were going to do the thing that Danielson talked about before Regal debuted – well, you just put Daniel Garcia, sports entertainer, with the Jericho butt-kissing sycophant society of suck-ups. And so he's not...
that was the
alternate
name, by the way.
Right. He's not part of the group. You know, he's not going to be... It doesn't so far appear he's going to be part of the group. No. Jericho took him instead. And so, you know, I mean, I guess you could get Lee Moriarty and stick him in there. But are they even going to do that? Or is it going to turn out to be they're not going to do that?
Question.
One of the lines I laughed hardest at tonight was during this match when Regal was on commentary and Danhausen came out and he asked, I think he referred to Excalibur as Mask. Pray tell, who is the demon waif? I popped big for that. I thought that was really, really funny.
It was.
Because that's really hard to explain to people who don't watch wrestling, and I'm not sure I understand it myself. It's definitely one of those let's see how it develops angles, right? I don't know what's going on with Morton, Daniel, Moxley, and Danielson right now.
Your take's exactly mine. I did not understand what they were going for. I am willing to give them time to clarify, but I would not say it's off to a good start. But just because I don't get it doesn't mean it won't end up in a good place, and this will all fall in. It'll all make sense. But to me, Moxley before the bell knocking Chuck Taylor off the ring apron is a dick move. It's not something you admire someone for doing. He's not the type of person who deserved that. That's not his character. Chuck Taylor didn't do anything to be obnoxious. I mean, I think he's kind of obnoxious, but that that has not been established, and he's generally, you know, seen as a likable, affable guy in kind of a cornball mid-card gimmick. And so
maybe.
I was like, okay, that's – oh, go ahead, Brian.
Maybe Moxley did that because he's pissed that Taylor hasn't been future endeavored yet.
maybe he wants to cut him from the roster. Regal slapping Wheeler like that reminded me of when Vince McMahon did it to that poor tough enough guy who could have made his career had he slapped Vince McMahon back. He'd still be doing the autograph circuit based on slapping Vince McMahon on live TV in response to being slapped hard by Vince without being told ahead of time. So they're going for something here. I'm fine with Wheeler dumping the best friends gimmick. He's good. The crowd, he's never had a crowd as into him as tonight, San Antonio crowd. I think Wheeler Yuta is good, but boy, he could use, you know, an edge. So I think he might be a good fit as a sort of a protege or underling that Moxley and Danielson abuse. I'm just not sure fans want to see Moxley be a heel, and we had a question on this on the Fix 2-3 weeks back. If I'm starting to just lose trust in Bryan Danielson's booking mind, like I just think he has like things that he thinks would be fun to do, but they don't really make sense. You know, the whole thing of getting people to boo, you know, like the environmental causes, and it's like, well, it's the way I say it. It's not the cause that makes me a heel. And it's like, yeah, but you're getting people to boo, you know, like trying to like not be reliant on Russian oil and climate change. And it's like, it goes against what he stands for. I didn't get that. And of course the vegan stuff, it's just like, that was dumb. And so I don't know. It seems a little self-indulgent sometimes what he's up to. And I really want this to make sense, but people love Regal. People love Mox. People love Danielson. And it feels like they're creating this faction that at least either they're like carefree, but not carefree. They're just like, they don't give a crap. They're just going to beat people up and you can like us or not like us. And maybe that'll work, but I don't know yet, you know? And it, yeah. And Regal's funny and people like him. And the speech last week was a babyface promo. So it just feels all over the place. And I don't like that anyway.
You know, I mean, there is such a thing as letting something develop. I know we live in a social media instant gratification culture where I want the thing resolved by the end of the second hour of Dynamite. It did feel this week that they were only on the show to give it a boost of star power. That's how I sort of felt it. Last week, it was their debut match against the Workhorsemen, who I guess ostensibly are heels, jobber heels. But, this week, it just felt like, well – we don't have we got some title matches, but we're not going to have Punk on TV. So we need Mox and or Danielson to boost a quarter.
Yeah. And we just need clarification. And I don't think the announcers were clued in or helping us along in terms of, were they told how to react? You know, it's like, is Regal slapping Yuta way out of line, or is that a way to test Yuta's toughness? And look, he didn't back down. He just stayed right there. And he scored points with Regal. Like, I just feel like I missed 2 weeks of television to explain to me what Regal's character is and how we're supposed to feel about him unprovoked slapping somebody who then, sort of sold it, but then got tough and stood in his face. And it just felt underdeveloped. I'm for giving things a chance, but I think the early stages should seem somewhat coherent and bring out an emotion that feels like it's intended within the context of the show. And I didn't get any sense that there was an intended emotion that was coherently triggered by what they did in the ring with the audience.
They weren't mic'd up either, right? So,
well, they're late to mic up Regal. We heard a little bit, but the announcer should know. You know, the announcer should be told on a sheet, like, here's what we're going for here. Here's a couple talking points. You know, I mean, Michael Cole, and people are going to be mad I'm touting something WWE does, but Michael Cole is like reading his script during commercial breaks. Like, he's turning pages. He's studying what has Vince McMahon and his writing team spent the last week talking about at length in order to get across the points that they want this match to get across. And then I was told in a production meeting, and now I've got my notes and I'm going to hit those points. And sometimes it seems sterile and staged and not at all improvised, and you can go too far with it. So it's I'm just pointing out, like, there might be a happy medium here, which is cluing the announcers so they can at least give us a talking point that helps us interpret something that feels ambiguous or contradictory about how we feel about the wrestlers based on what we have seen up until this week.
My guess is, with the way Tony kind of books, they know where they're going, but they have so much time between pay-per-views that we got all day to get there, right?
Yeah, but why have a week where people – why do what they did this week if it doesn't have an intended emotional reaction that is coherently triggered in the viewers, where you are in concert with your people who mic people up and your announcers and the stage that was set? I don't know. I mean, well, maybe I'm overreacting to something that I'm not seeing that will just fall into place in the next couple of weeks, but I'm a little lost right now. Brian, back to you.
Yeah, I heard Vince McMahon's name mentioned a couple of times while you guys were talking. I will say my piece on Vince McMahon, and then I'll move on. I consider him a horrible human being who never gave a damn about his wrestlers. You could see the long list of people who have died along the way. Owen Hart and everything, and you can feel free to edit this part out of the podcast later, but when he finally dies, I will not miss him. But anyway, strong statement. But
you're not getting a tribute when you die either by him after what you just said.
Yeah.
There's no video package on you of your highlights on the calling up the post show here.
Well, unlike him, I'm actually a decent human being, and I care about my fellow man, which he clearly does not.
Yeah.
Because if he actually did, he wouldn't be going to Saudi Arabia so often. But anyway, yeah, and all the wrestlers who go to Saudi Arabia as well, in my opinion, are sellouts. Anyway, I'm going to go out on a limb here, and I think Bret Hart's coming to AEW because I forget which Jackson teased it, but the best there is during that little thing with the Young Bucks and FTR, and you know, there has been a little bit of Twitter activity with FTR praising Bret Hart and things. And they wouldn't tease something like that unless there was something going on. I'm going out on a limb, and I'm saying Bret Hart is coming in as the manager of the FTR. Just wondering your guys' thoughts on that, especially considering that FTR has not been booked very well by Tony Khan lately, to say the least.
Yeah. Yeah, I like
they've been vocal about that on Twitter, right? their booking and how they're being handled, for sure.
Yeah.
So they do, to your point, they do have the Owen Hart tournament coming up. It's not until May, but, you know, it would be a good time to have Bret Hart on your television.
Well, I'm not talking temporary. I'm talking for as long as they want to have him as FTR's manager. I'm not talking just that special appearance. I'm talking about, like, an actual storyline.
Yeah, I mean, if you were going to do that, it makes sense to do it as your the Owen Hart tournament is on TV.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And
he could serve as a mouthpiece to promote that and talk about his brother and how great his brother was. That FTR Bucks, you know, thing backstage, so we're FTR... was on Twitter complaining that, you know, we were not sure what's going on. First, we were with the Young Bucks, and we thought it was going to be a series of matches. It was so hyped on social media, and then we had one and done, right? So, is this a case of tweet and ye shall receive? Seems like it. But we're running it back, but it's with FTR as faces and the Bucks as heels. And I'm sure you talked about it last week, but that Tully turn just was rushed, came out of the blue. It felt like guy whose contract was expiring or a Cody Rhodes leaving casualty.
Yep.
And so, if anybody could get FTR over as faces, it certainly would be Bret Hart, who is held in high esteem by just about everybody. Besides
Brian, what else?
He'll be in AEW. I guarantee it. Except unlike JBL at WrestleMania 21, my prediction will actually come true. But that's gonna pull a rabbit out of the hat. All right. The women's title match. It was good. It wasn't great. It wasn't as good as their Lights Out match, because I don't like the way that they booked Britt Baker against Thunder Rosa at the last two matches, including at Revolution, because they made her look really weak, as opposed to, like, earlier points in her run. And, like, they had Thunder Rosa beating her multiple times at Revolution and then in this match as well. And I just think they kind of made her look weaker than they should have. And for God's sake, do we have to see the thumbtacks every freaking week or whatever? It's so stupid. It's an overplayed cliche. It's not necessary. Leave the thumbtacks under the ring. Why they're even under the ring, I don't know. I think JR said something about that. But for God's sake, just don't do the stupid thumbtacks.
Fans have to stop popping for them if you want them to go away. And as long as crowds are popping for the thumbtacks, we're going to get thumbtack spots. I'm think it's played out, and it feels like a geek show or some rite of passage or something.
Put some broken glass.
No, just tell a good story in the ring with moves. You got, thousands to choose from. And it's like, you can write a good book by not inventing words and changing grammar. It's how you use the words that have always been around, while having the structure of grammar that's there to create a sense of order and cadence and art to writing. And when you just, to me, thumbtacks is outside of that, the vast majority of the time it's used. And it just feels like a shortcut geek show for somebody who, is choosing not to tell a story more artfully and athletically otherwise. And that's how I see it. But, I admire matches that don't include that stuff more. I am also aware, I am cognizant, I am observant of the fact that there are people who like it, and it's not all about me, but that's my opinion on it. I don't get excited when I see a bag of thumbtacks. I kind of roll my eyes and go, oh, okay, you're doing this.
Those are the kinds of people.
Go ahead, Eric.
maybe save it for the pay-per-view so it's not so played out as Bryant is talking about, right? It's,
or save it for 2026 when it feels fresh again.
Yeah.
Yeah, for a minute there, I thought Cody returned to book the Thunder Rosa Britt Baker match because it was so overstuffed. The only thing we were missing was the outside interference, right? If that would have happened, I would have been like, oh, Cody is back booking this match.
Or including a sledgehammer.
Yeah. All right, yeah, go ahead, Brian. What else?
Yeah, I thought when Baker was reaching out of the ring, she was going to get a sledgehammer for a minute. But then when I saw the bag of tacks, I was like, God, can we leave that back in the late 90s with Taker and Foley, which was the last time it actually worked? But anyway, was there thumbtacks in that match? I don't remember. But last point. And kind of the broader women's picture, like the Jade Cargill sort of open challenge thing, it seems like they're leaving it open-ended. I'm wondering if maybe, I know Toni Storm's non-compete clause expires on March 29th. Are they perhaps leaving that open for her to dethrone? Jade Cargill is the TBS champion because somebody's going to have to beat her eventually, and I can't really think of
That'll
anyone
be a big
better
deal.
Right
yeah.
now than her. So anyway, thanks to you guys, and I'll take the answer up here.
Thanks, Brian. Cool. Good topics. Yeah, Eric, have you thought about who would be the right person and Jade Cargill's streak? I mean, a baby face Britt Baker? Are we leading to that being, you know, kind of the ultimate women's division super fight, two champions on two different paths, although Baker just lost tonight. She was a perennial champion identified with a whole era of AEW as a top star. Fans like her. She eventually goes babyface. You could do that against heel Cargill, or you could keep Britt heel and have Jade go babyface and have them face off there, and then that's but it makes more sense if Baker's a face to be the one who ends the streak. But ideally, you would use it to get somebody new over, or in the case of Toni Storm, somebody who has been under – the perception is she's been underutilized, and use that as sort of a way to send a signal to the fan base. We believe in her. We've given her this big spot. Your thoughts on that and anyone else who comes to mind?
I mean, I think I am in no rush to see them end the Jade Cargill undefeated streak. It's one of the best things she has going for her, right, because it does have the – for longtime fans, the echoes of Goldberg back in the day that helped him get over. The only note I really took is, other than who's the next opponent, I still don't know, is AEW doesn't, just in terms of sheer quantity of women wrestlers to run through, they don't have a lot, right, on the roster that they're willing to, you know, to bury. I mean, you're willing to bury a Julia Hart, Anna Jay's lost to her, but at some point they're going to run, you know, Ruby Soho has lost to Jade, I think. At some point, you're going to run out of women wrestlers to keep, you know, adding wins to the streak, or there's going to be repeats, or you're just going to bring in a bunch of, you know, jobber women, you know, local talents or whatever for Jade to continue her streak. All that said, I'm not in any hurry to end Jade's winning streak. When you do, I don't think that the wrestler who does, I don't think is currently on the AEW roster. I think, you know, I could see a Toni Storm would be a good choice to get her over right away. Or an Ember Moon, right? Ember Moon has enough badassery, you know, badassery kind of an image where she could come in and be believable in beating Jade, right? Who's this specimen who's a dominator and is taller than all the other women and very muscular. And so, mean, I don't know. I know because it's weekly television and you tend to burn when it's weekly television, especially the way Tony Khan books with surprises and, you know, it's not Crash TV, but he's clearly surprises and debuts are a big part of his booking and goosing the crowd because they're proven crowd pleasers and favorites. Everybody pops for news when they're live in the arena. And it's exciting, generates headlines. But, you know, and everything is so sped up these days because of just the pace of how television works and AEW's primarily a television company. But heck, I don't know. I keep the belt on Jade the whole year, you know, through all of 2022.
Yeah, I'm definitely in no rush to move on from that. All right. It's time for Javier. He's up next.
All right. Going down to Miami, talking to Javier.
Javier, welcome. PWTorch.com contributor, PWTorch podcaster, and cleanup batter for our shows here, joining us for the roundtable portion of the program. Javier, welcome.
Hey, Wade. Hey, Eric, how's it going?
Well, you know, Javier, I don't get intro music. You're put over huge. You're getting the mega push from Wade Keller here.
If you called every week, Eric, for like, you know, 2 years, you know, you could get a jingle. It was, speaking of streaks, you know, Javier had a streak of hundreds of shows calling and joining us. So.
Yeah, I just to put myself over, I think I helped out a lot during the pandemic era with
absolutely.
You know, so. You know.
And you bring the analysis. You bring it every week like Javier, and I'll get you a jingle in 2 years.
Noted.
I don't want to discourage you either. I like the jingle, but yours won't be as cool.
I can't imagine a worse thing than having a jingle on this show.
Oh, Javier.
maybe being ripped apart by Todd, that would be worse, but yeah.
Go ahead, Javier. Eric has just dissed your jingle.
No, for me personally, I'm happy for Javier that he has entrance music. Yeah. I just would not want that for myself.
Well,
I don't like putting myself over.
Guess what you're getting next time. All right, go ahead, Javier.
We've got to be ostentatious. Although now I'm really angry with Brian because I thought I was the only one who caught the Bret Hart thing. I'm like, are you serious? Because they had been talking about it, and the thought occurred to me a while ago. But then when the Young Bucks came out and they say, we don't care if you're the best there's ever been, I'm like, oh. I was going to ask you, is it realistic that they bring him in on a, you know, reoccurring case to, you know, be their manager? Because that was the other, because it was also CM Punk who, paraphrasing, basically said that, you know, he should be the one going to Saudi Arabia making millions of dollars instead of the other guy. It could be that, they're going to, find a way to give him a payday.
Yeah.
Does Bret Hart really want to come in for weekly television at this point in his life?
I don't know. I mean, he might. I mean, he might be itching to get on the road and see the fans and get cheered again. I mean, it's intoxicating. People who go through a stretch of time walking out into a crowd of thousands and thousands and sometimes tens of thousands of people cheering them miss it. I thought Adam Copeland was someone who would not miss it. He'd go mountain biking and be happy and not need it, and he has been very clear he missed it, and he felt he didn't finish on his terms, and, you know, people enjoy that stuff. Mick Foley, I just saw him last week at his stand-up show at Mall of America. He was on tour and stopped there, and it's like, be in front of a crowd who reacts to what you're doing and has this history with you is intoxicating, it's addicting, it's validating, and I don't know where Bret is right now, but I wouldn't rule out that he wouldn't mind having a run of a few months, and maybe he wants some money to buy something cool that he can't justify unless he earns it doing something extra in 2022. So, but yeah, I mean, he might change his mind, Eric, after 3 weeks of airports.
he might
be like, this is why I was happy when I retired, and then I forgot what a pain this is. It's like, you know, drinking, and then, and, you know, you're like, oh, this is fun, and the next day you're like, that's why I don't drink as often as I used to. But anyway, no personal experience there. Go ahead, Javier.
And the other thing I have that of like, what I think where things are going, with the whole Wheeler Yuta thing, I think Wheeler Yuta eventually does join, Regal's group. But you mentioned Dante Martin, it could, he could get, you know, not be happy being a lapdog for Jericho. Jump ship to them, and then you have a 4-on-4 sports entertainer versus wrestlers, because, you know, they made it a point to call Regal's group, you know, these guys are real wrestlers.
Mm-hmm.
So do you think that we're looking at the early building blocks for their eventual blood and guts match 4-on-4?
Well, Eric, what do you think?
I'm sorry, who versus Eddie Kingston and Proud and Powerful?
Regal's group versus a 2.0 down the road. Because one's calling themselves entertainers, and then the other one being hit hard over the head that they're calling themselves wrestlers.
I think the first feud, obviously, because they set it up last week, and I was glad they kept Kingston and Santana Ortiz off television because it was good that they sold, they're selling their injuries for a week. And they didn't run in tonight, right? You could do that next week or 2 weeks from now or whatever. I thought about, it certainly they seem to be setting that up, but how many 2.0 Daniel Garcia matches versus both Moxley and Danielson have we already seen? I was there live for the first one, CM Punk's debut show. The main event of that show was Moxley versus Daniel Garcia, and it's like I just feel like I've seen every possible permutation of that already. So I'm not really looking to see that. I know they both sides have been remixed and there's new gimmicks and all that, but I don't know. I just generally have a hard time. 2.0 and Daniel Garcia have been portrayed as jobbers to this point, and so it's like I guess the Appreciation Society is version 2.0 of the Inner Circle, but it's like Jericho remade it, and he just wants guys who are going to kiss his ass instead of having independent thought, and he picked a bunch of guys who aren't really highly established. Maybe he's trying to give them a rub, but, so far that hasn't played out, right? I still view 2.0 as enhancement guys, who are good promos.
Javier, let me ask you what you thought of the – oh, go ahead, Javier. I'm going to ask
I meant Daniel Garcia. Daniel Garcia jumping over to Regal's group. So Regal's group would be Brian, Moxley, Garcia, and Yuta would be them, and then the other group would be 2.0, Swagger, and Jericho.
I mean, it'd be a way to elevate a bunch of guys, right? Younger guys.
Yeah.
I don't know. If they wanted to do that at like a 4-on-4 as some sort of double or nothing, they still got to get through, I think, Eddie and Santana and Ortiz first, right?
Yeah.
That's the feud they set up.
Yeah, I'm talking about
step
way
one.
Down the road. Way down the road. Like after, they're each going to do their own thing. And, I'm talking about like maybe for the next pay-per-view or the next event after the next pay-per-view.
Well, Javier, I want to ask you just in a more macro or a more micro sense, what you thought of the way that Danielson and Mox and Regal were presented, and if you think it portrayed a more clear, crisp vision of if it was more crisp and clear what the vision is for that group than I was able to gather from the cheap shot by Moxley before the bell, the slap by Regal, Yuta standing up to him, Danielson standing in the background, yipping and laughing and smiling like a heel would be doing. But then Moxley is this beloved figure who now is part of this. And Regal was beloved last week, but now – and is funny on commentary, but now – so, like, what is going on? Like, am I thinking too hard? They're just all baby-faced badasses and don't pay attention to the details of how they act? What's going on?
If you're hoping for me to, settle your troubled mind, I think you're screwed because I kind of felt the same way you did.
Yeah.
Because it's like, because the problem is I think what they're trying to do is, like, have them be violent and do violent stuff, but in a way that you're going to kind of cheer for them. Like, kind of how, like, people would cheer, like, for Minoru Suzuki nowadays, where, he's throwing young boys a lot around and you're like cheering for that, but I don't think it's really been established to begin with, and they're coming across a little bit more heelish than just like people who want to be violent. So I kind of think that's kind of what they're going for, is like a violent group without crossing over to the heelish territory. But the attack before the bell, that is a dirty, a dirty thing. And also Regal on commentary mentioned that, we're going to teach the young kids how to fight dirty. And I'm like, okay, that's definitely for me heelish. But then at the same time, you kind of – they're being portrayed as cool too. So, yeah, I agree with you where I'm kind of like don't know what exactly to feel about the group. I'm hoping that it would be, you know, with like another week or two, we would get a better sense of things, you know, on – because like I'm thinking that somehow Yuta is going to end up joining them, and whether that's going to be where, you know, he basically, you know, attacks the best friends and then jump ship that way. Well, that's not a face way to do it. So I'd be more like, okay, this is a heelish group. You know, so I'm kind of torn on that, waiting to see what happens and how the next, you know, what the next thing is. But you're right. I mean, I would have liked some clarity too.
Yeah, yeah. So what
patience,
else
grasshoppers, patience.
Well, yeah, but you say patience, but if the opening act is clumsily done, and there's no way you can see, you're not coming out of it with a clear emotional reaction. I think it's worth not just saying, well, I'm not going to say anything until I know where it's going. I mean, I think it's worth evaluating this opening chapter and not just going, I'm sure it'll work out. I don't know what you're pitching when you say have patience, other than are you acknowledging it was a mess, but hey, it might get better? Or are you saying don't analyze it yet?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know where it's going, but I'm confident given AEW's track record, I'm going to find out soon enough, within a week or two.
But does that mean the opening chapter was good?
I think the opening chapter was just like, you know how Ocean's 11 was fantastic and Ocean's 12 kind of sucked,
yeah,
and Ocean's 13 was kind of a rebound? I think we're in the last week was just, you know, the pay-per-view, and last week was just the star power carrying them. And this week it was like, okay, what are we doing here? And it's unclear. This week was the sort of the Ocean's 12 of the trio. And I'm confident given the people involved here that they'll sort it out. We'll find out soon enough.
Yeah, fair enough. Yep. All right, go ahead, Javier. What else for us?
I agree with what you said on the women's match, because when it started, I'm like, okay, it's the last match of the night. Hopefully they're going to give them enough time for what they want to do. And then when I saw that they were just not selling anything and moving from one spot to the next spot, I was like, okay, apparently they don't have enough time to do what they want to do.
Yeah.
You know,
the pessimistic view, Javier, is that that went exactly as they planned, and they didn't plan to sell. They didn't plan to transition, and it was just, let's cram in a bunch of spots and get a This Is Awesome chant, which is, you know, everything I stand against in wrestling. But
yeah, I'm gonna give them the benefit of the doubt, hopefully. I mean, you know, I'm an optimist. So you had mentioned about when WWE went into the whole, you know, superstar thing. When I remember them really starting the whole, like, corporate cult speak, was around the time they did the Get the F Out. I mean, I know there's stuff that, you know, I think the superstar stuff had already kind of happened before that, because I remember in ECW, you know, it was the first time I remember hearing This Is Wrestling chants. You know, which was, you know, to rub in, you know, that this is wrestling, not what WWE does. So, but that would have been around the same time they did the Get the F Out. That was around the time I remember them, like, really start hammering, like, brand languaging in around that time period.
Yeah, that sounds about right. It feels – I mean, there might have been little surges along the way, but I feel like Vince has just been on this trajectory, this sort of evolution of being particular with words. And, I mean, with an understanding that it might backfire or be seen, ridiculed. There are particular – there. Vince McMahon caring about the language that is used and trying to get everybody on the same page about being precise with their language, in spirit, I'm in favor of. I just think it's too stridently done, and at times clunkiness in the spirit of clarity leads to something other than a tone that you want to be predominant on your pro wrestling show. But, you know, the idea of, like, you know, letting people talk in sort of colloquialism and casual about I want a title shot and banning that, and everyone has to say, you know, championship opportunity, it's like, I get where he's coming from, but, or, you know, feud instead of a rivalry instead of feud, but it's just too, it feels like a police state taken to the degree that he does it. And it, you know, it feels unnatural, but it seems like he's been on this path, you know, ever since he was, you know, promoting in the mid-80s. I mean, so, but yeah, I think there probably was a surge around that time, Javier.
And I remember, wasn't there a Mick Foley story where he when they started doing the whole, you know, calling WWE superstars instead of wrestlers, that he got the flight attendant to say, want to welcome aboard the WWE superstars and Al Snow?
Sounds familiar.
I think that was in one of his books, but yeah.
Yeah.
I think that's pretty much it. I mean, the moment I hang up, I want to remember, oh, my God, I forgot to say anything. But
yeah, let me ask this, and then we'll get to some emails here. The Hardys debut, they're mega over, crowds totally into Jeff Hardy, which has to make Matt feel great, the story of his life now in AEW. But is this a nostalgia tour pop, or is it sustainable? Can Matt and Jeff keep up with the teams that they're going to be facing, or will they be strategic in putting the Hardys, say, against, you know, 2.0, another Matt and Jeff? Well, they have new names now. And let, you know, the you know, because 2.0 are really good at what they do. And I think AEW is like, who cares what they did with them in NXT? This is a talented, smart, obnoxious heel act who can go and are respected by their peers. Let's just use them the way they should be. And, you know, just get the Hardys in kind of a sidebar feud with them. Like, what's the arc of the Hardys in AEW beyond the nostalgia pop that we're getting now? Is this the New Age Outlaws when they made their comeback a few years back? Javier, you first, then Eric.
Well, I just mentioned that I knew I was going to forget something. That was what I forgot. You had mentioned the loud pops. Jeff Hardy was one of the ones that stood out to me too. You know, he was like super over, and I'm like over to the point. I'm like, just give him the title. You know, like, you know, you could put Jeff Hardy in the title rotation and give him a shot at that with how over he was, and you might as well just strike, you know, and give him one shot now. But that's on the Jeff Hart. As far as the other thing, I mean, I remember seeing the ladder wars they had with the Young Bucks when, you know, before they went to the WWE, and I mean, I think they could probably get something. I mean, I don't want them to necessarily do something as crazy as that, but I think they could have, you know, a decent, like, one more last, like, run, you know, at the titles, and then after that maybe Jeff can, you know, do something on the singles. I mean, I don't know, like, what shape Matt is in, but, you know, I mean, Jeff Hardy just seems like he just doesn't care. So, I mean, you know, yeah. Doing the swan
tom. That's part of what makes it cool, but.
Yeah, but, and, you know, and I like the pairing with Darby Allin and Sting in that whole thing. They kind of, like, worked well together. I mean,
right.
I'd like to see them get one more run, you know, and not necessarily win the titles, but, like, you know, this is, like, we're our run, and I think they're also going to be doing stuff in the indies, too.
Yeah. Eric, what do you think? What's the arc for the Hardys?
I mean, I think, the Hardys have an indie run coming up. They're going to be 15 minutes from my house at some point, I think this month or next month, against, I don't know who they're wrestling, but they're on the card being promoted. I mean, I think this was a logical follow-up match from last week when they did the big heat angle with the split. Jeff Hardy is so over. Matt Hardy, I think, he probably shouldn't resent his brother. If you ask me, conspiracy theory, they cooked this up together. Jeff Hardy's going to wander off during a match in WWE and then get released. I think WWE played right into their hand. I think this was totally intentional. And Matt wanted Jeff to come to AEW because Matt has sort of at the end of his tether, right? He's done everything he can do. Jeff helps keep him relevant for a little longer. They don't need to be, you know, the work rate in AEW is high. They don't need to be world beaters, though, because you saw tonight Private Party created the movement, right? They got heat on Matt before the crowd went absolutely nuclear for the hot tag. What a pop when Jeff got the hot tag. And you saw tonight, the crowd got what they wanted. They got their Hardy Boy comeback and win. it seems like you have built-in feuds going forward with Butcher and Blade, because they were, you know, part of the beatdown, and then Andrade and a partner, I guess, right, to settle that score. That's sort of in the near term. You also have Sting and Darby, because Darby's either just staring in awe at Jeff Hardy when he comes out to save him, or they're, it seemed like they were setting up maybe a match down the road. But, you know, then you have what I would call the fantasy camp, the matches from all the top tag teams that would want to have them, with the Hardys, FTR, the Young Bucks, Red Dragon. You can even do Malakai Black and Brody King, or Buddy Matthews. No shortage of matches for them on a tag team run. And I think, to answer your question, I think it's more than a nostalgia tour push, right? I mean, it's more like fantasy matchups that the wrestlers themselves always wanted to have. And so the wrestlers are going to work their asses off to try and make the matches work. And the younger guys are going to work hard to make sure that their match with the Hardys is good. The part where I will part ways with them is if they start doing the Matt Hardy universe, multiverse nonsense. I just don't understand any of that, and I think it's stupid.
Very good. Javier, any closing words from you?
I haven't had time to think this through completely, but I have a feeling that they're kind of shifting heavy into tag teams right now. Like, that's going to be their focus for the near bit here. Cause the stuff with the FTR and, Young Bucks, you also have, FTR and, Pride and Powerful, who's also, you know, they've been really over and people are like really behind them. It feels like a lot of the tag teams are kind of like bubbling up in terms of, you know, the hottest acts right now, in AEW. While you have a colder Hangman Adam Page, and you know that
all right,
come colder.
On now. You're, like you're, the... I know that's fake, but I'm going to rise to it here when you get done speaking, though.
But yeah, so it just feels like there's a little bit of a pivot that, you know, maybe the next pay per view's main event is going to be a tag team main event as opposed to a singles main event.
Eric.
So the thing I enjoyed the most on the show, the best match on tonight's show, was the opening six-man tag. It felt like the sort of early on AEW Dynamites, right? Where these guys actually had a story. Back when the AEW started on Dynamite, it was just, let's throw six really good workers out and let them go balls to the wall, and it always was like exciting and paid off. Now, if you don't like that sort of spot fest match, you probably didn't like the opening match, but I loved it because I'm willing to go with it. Paige, I couldn't believe the pop Paige got. It was huge. It was nice to see.
Yes.
Now, I don't know if that's Cowboy in Texas. It's as simple as that. Cowboy in San Antonio. But, you know, they had a, you know, the usual match, the usual psychology of how they worked it with, the, you know, getting the heat on the baby face. They had that great triple moonsault spot. But, you know, in the hot tag to Luchasaurus. But what I didn't understand about this opening match was I don't understand the psychology. Hangman Page beat Adam Cole clean. It wasn't a fluke. It wasn't a roll-up. It was he got him at the pay-per-view. And then they're continuing this feud. I don't – you know, JR at the end is like, they have unfinished business. I'm like, well, what unfinished business do they have? The tag team champions beat – you know, they emerged victorious at the pay-per-view, and so did Page. I mean, are they just milking this for another – Hangman Page, Adam Cole match? If so, I'm not sure the finish really added to that, because if you were going to run back Page and Cole, you'd want to have Cole pin Page, right, to set up the match. But Cole beat Jungle Boy yet again, and nor does that set up a tag team title match, right? So I didn't quite understand the booking. Maybe you guys have a little more insight into where the, you know.
Maybe Javier does, but the unfinished business is Cole said, you beat me once, but I beat you 99 out of 100 times. It was a fluke. And so now let's have a match, and then it turned into a tag match, which was going to prove something. And the match ended with Adam Cole beating Jungle Boy. So I mean, that's the storyline wrap-up. I think the issue is Cole thinks Hangman beating him was a fluke. Javier, I'll throw to you in a second. I do want to underline, that was a crowd reaction Hangman Page will remember forever. And if his confidence was down, this should have reignited a sense of momentum, WWE, copyright WWE, and the Cowboy Shit chant cheer, the cheering for him and the Cowboy Shit chant and the reaction he got, it seemed like he was like visibly moved by it. And also, Eric, in my report after I watched this match, I said, this felt like old school Dynamite. And then I said, can we say that yet? But it was. It was like, we're done with these talking segments. We want a million plus people watching the show. And we're going back to what brought us here. And that is just ringing the bell and having, you know, a bunch of wrestlers who can go, just go for 15 minutes, which is what this was. But Javier, back to you on the storyline thing.
Well, on the Jungle Boy thing, the only reason I could think of why they pin him is if they want to start creating a story that there's blood in the water, that Jungle Boy's weak, and start having the tag teams coming after him, targeting him for some reason. I think that might be what they might what that entails, because I don't know why else they would have Cole, you know, pin Jungle Boy in the. It just seemed like it was a weird. Well, I mean, he couldn't do Page, and he couldn't do. And wouldn't and yeah I guess if you're going to have that team go over, that would have been the only way to really do it. But I think that's also something you could do with Jungle Boy is, you know, say that, you know, he may be the weak link, and some teams could play off on that.
I think they did it because they think JB can lose and still come back and win people over by doing great moves and being athletic and likable. I think it might be that simple because they feel like Luchasaurus is the big wrestler in the match, would be hurt more by losing, and of course they're protecting Hangman. Yeah, Eric.
But if you wanted to go to Jungle Boy and Luchasaurus, Jurassic Express versus Red Dragon next, then one of the two Red Dragon members pins Jungle Boy and not Cole. And so that's why it didn't intuitively make sense to me. I will not so all of the blasphemy that's gone on with Hangman Page, he has now been on two of the three biggest drawing AEW pay-per-views. He has headlined them. He has main evented them. Now, look, I'll admit that the last one was probably mostly drawn on MJF CM Punk, right?
Yeah.
Just like CM Punk's debut match maybe popped their biggest buy rate of all time at All Out. I know it's an ensemble show, but, you know, Page does get overshadowed by the bigger stars with the bigger names on his own show. He's not unlike CM Punk when he was trying to be WWE champion in that way, right? Where they they booked him, did not book him in the main event. But I don't like a rematch with Cole because assuming that Page is going to win, then you've had Cole look, you know, lose to him twice, and you sort of defined him down a little bit. And I think Adam Cole is a great talent and you know, potential future top star for them. And it's just weird. It just the psychology is weird because if Page hit him with a schoolboy and that's how he won, great. Then Cole can say it's lucky, but you know, it wasn't that. And so you know, I don't know where they're headed, but again, they've got 14 Dynamites before the next pay-per-view. So they have at least two interim programs for Hangman Page, right? And a rematch with Cole may be one of them.
Javier, thank you as always.
Oh, one quick thing. My notes suck.
Yeah.
You mentioned the cell rules. That was a mistake by Tony Schiavone. I don't know if they mentioned it during this match, but they have in previous cell matches. That if someone leaves the ring, they are, I'm not sure if the wording was disqualified or they forfeit the match if they leave the ring. Yeah, sorry, not the ring, but they leave the cage. So I don't know if that means that there'll be a change in, you know, the belt will also transfer and change hands. I'm not sure if they ever made that point, but it would be a disqualification leaving the ring.
And I would say don't draw attention to that because the point of a cage match is to stop a wrestler who gets intentionally counted out to keep their title from doing so. And if you establish if they're quick enough and climb fast enough, they can, you know, keep their title in a cheap way also. I mean, it defeats the purpose of the cage match, but it also creates drama when the babyface chases them down and grabs their boot and yanks them to the mat. So, I mean, like I said, it's not a huge deal. It's just, but I'm glad, you know, there is some structure to it that has been addressed prior.
Yeah, and they could just easily, you know, cover that up by saying, if it's an issue where you actually want, you know, like let's say a heel escapes the cage and then that gets himself disqualified to hold on the belt. They've done that, you know, that that was what when what's his name? Elvis impersonator in WWE. God, what's his name?
Honky Tonk
Man. Honky Tonk
Man.
Yeah.
Honky Tonk Man. There we go. Wow. long night. Honky Tonk Man. You know how he? I that would just drive me nuts as a kid on how he would get, you know, get away with the not actually defending the belt. So you know, you could just have once that happens, then you say, okay, well, if you get disqualified, you lose the belt, and so you leave the cage, you lose the belt. So there are ways you could tackle that, but yeah, I mean, at least it's a good first step.
yeah, for sure. All right,
so,
Javier, thank you.
For real, that's it. For real, that's it.
Yes, that is. Sounds good.
Have a good day.
Thanks as always. Yep, you too. All right, Eric, let's zip through some emails here. Is that all right? You got the energy and time. Let's start with Zach in Texas. The Jericho promo was another stroke of brilliance from the master of reinvention. The minute Jericho referred to them as a group of sports entertainers, I immediately thought of Sports Entertainment Extreme from TNA. The JAS, Jericho Appreciation Society, is so much better, though, because it's done with a wink and a nod and not a reflection of how the booker really feels about the business he's in. Also, the centerpiece of the group is an arrogant heel wrestler, not a cockroach making money off the business he doesn't respect. My only critique is that Jericho needs to change entrance music because the crowd will forever sing Judas, and if he's going to be a heel, that probably shouldn't be happening. I thought, Eric, that they were going to say, that was like 2.0 is going to say, this is the last time you're going to hear that music. You hope you people enjoyed it. We're making sure, you know, Jericho doesn't ever play this again. He agrees with us. Put heat on and, you know, put heat on them for doing it, but also just create a storyline reason to get rid of it. It's a great television moment, but it does not belong with a heel. It's bad enough that Adam Cole is, you know, playing to the crowd for cheers as he's trying to get over as a heel and then has to sort of undo the cool factor of his entrance. But same thing with Jericho. You know, if you're going to be a heel, be a heel.
Yeah, I mean, one, I don't think Tony Khan is booking this. I think Jericho comes up with his own creative and runs it by Tony Khan, and Tony Khan says, yeah, sounds great, Chris.
Yeah.
The Judas thing, I absolutely agree. I'm like, still with the Judas? He's a heel. I think, you know, change it up. Doesn't Chris have a new album coming out, right? Doesn't his band have a new album coming out where he can pull another song that he wants to push to get that promotion?
Yeah.
Ironically, I think it was JR in commentary who said he's actually a Judas now, right, because he turned heel. But Jericho was on a podcast. I saw somebody, maybe Fightful, wrote it up today, and Jericho was asked this very question, like, isn't it time to ditch the Judas? And he was kind of – a recollection is he kind of wanted to have it both ways. Well, yes, but we want the fans love this thing. It was organically created, and you know, he wants to have his cake and eat it too. You know, it took – you know, as you noticed, I'm sure, it took Jericho a long time to get that crowd to turn on him, right? He had to start talking about the fans don't appreciate me before they did. Jericho has a plethora of nicknames. He was called the Influencer and the Big One, and then he dubbed himself the Sports Entertainer. I actually, as an old person, think the Influencer is brilliant because I hate that instantly because I think that's all ridiculous. And if you're young, it works for you because you're like, how is this old fart an influencer? Influencers are really sexy people in their teens and early 20s, right? So to me, the influencer thing might be a little hacky and cliched, but it works. You know, I'm willing to see where it goes with the Sports Entertainer.
All right, so up next, JB in Detroit says, I'm a bit torn on how I feel about the Jericho Appreciation Society. On one hand, I feel like Jericho continually does amazing work reinventing his career and getting his desired reaction, whether he's a face or a heel. On the other hand, I feel like Sports Entertainer and being sports entertained and beating up pro wrestlers might be a little too meta for my liking. Also, I think one might argue that it is low-hanging fruit and cheap heat. Do you find yourself agreeing more with the former or latter? As always, love the show and go VIP. So yes, I mean, I'm for this low-hanging fruit because not enough people take swings at it. And, you know, again, it's aligned correctly. You know, the heel embracing the term sports entertainer is, in the AEW, is great. It's infringing to me a little bit on MJF. MJF, you know, I could see him, you know, since he's sort of, you know, not lobbying, but saying I'd be equally happy over in, you know, WWE when my contract's up. It's all about who pays me the most. And, you know, he without going explicitly
in that direction, I could have seen, you know, based on the past, I could have seen MJF cutting this promo too and going from now on, I want to be referred to this way. I think it works better with Jericho, but it does infringe a little bit on the heat MJF was going for.
I think MJF is going to be focused on his Wardlow feud for the near term, so that clears the path for Jericho. If in the end Jericho is trying to elevate Daniel Garcia in 2.0, as he is, you know, he's done pretty well in elevating talent, right?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, he knows that's what it was a good idea. They had him as their first champion to establish the company and the brand with somebody who the fans knew. But everybody he works with, he's tried to elevate MJF, Orange Cassidy, Eddie Kingston. And so that's been cool of Chris Jericho. And, you know, but we'll see how this plays out.
It has
the potential to, I guess, supposed to be a bit one note. And, but I think I have the confidence in Chris Jericho as a creative force to know he kind of has a good sense for this stuff, right? He is the Madonna of pro wrestling, always inventing himself. Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. I just lost my point regarding Madonna.
You were voguing there in Minneapolis?
Yeah. Oh, I was thinking, is Matt Lee going to be Ralphus? It was worth forgetting, not repeating, but is Matt Lee going to be like Jericho's Ralphus, like his kind of like comedy relief, or is he going to be kind of the obnoxious guy who actually has some credibility? But it's fun. He's going to be who he is. Matt and Jeff are going to be who they are. They're going to carve out their own category, but Jericho can work with a variety of different types, and I'm looking forward to the chemistry. Danny Garcia in 2.0, like, you've seen the stuff on, I think it was on Being the Elite, I think one week, or maybe it was on one of the countdown shows where Matt, the 2.0 were just talking, cutting a promo backstage, and Danny Garcia was just cracking up, like legit, just looking at them and just totally thoroughly entertained by them. There's a genuine chemistry there, and it's fun seeing them stick together. And then I'm looking forward to it. I'm a fan of Garcia and 2.0, and I've been taken a little by surprise at the fact that 2.0 have, to me, earned their keep and their TV time that they've gotten. I was a little skeptical of when they hired them, and I assumed they would just be jobbers. But I think they have talked and wrestled their way into a pretty cool situation right now.
Well, they have been jobbers, as has Daniel Garcia up to this point, right? The only wins they really get come on Dark. I think the goal here should be to get Daniel Garcia over, right? I mean, Matt and Jeff are in their late 30s, I think, and so – you know, if it was going to happen for them, it would have happened by now. And they're perfectly serviceable as the sort of job guys with a good good ability to talk and draw heat on themselves and get a little bit of offense in the baby phase. But Daniel Garcia actually has a future, right? I mean, he is a potential combination of Bryan Danielson and Zack Sabre Jr. And I'm really looking forward to seeing his growth.
I will take issue with calling them jobbers. I think they're wrestlers who lose almost all the time, and I think that is different than jobbers. I mean, a lot of pushed wrestlers just have losing records. And to me, a jobber isn't somebody who wins on Dark. A jobber is somebody who doesn't get promo time, doesn't get TV time, and they're there to take bumps and make the stars look good. They're characters, pushed characters, featured characters, but in the case of Danny Garcia, he's an up-and-comer who hasn't won a big match yet, and that's a story they're telling, but he's not a jobber just because he loses all the time. I don't think that's the definition of a jobber.
They're not the Iron Mike Sharp of Duke Doherty of the modern era.
SD Jones, no.
Yeah. Okay.
All right. Brian from Phoenix says, Vince's term sports entertainer doesn't strike much of a nerve with me. I think that it's less important with executives and advertisers as it is with casual fans to not have to justify the goofy or implausible aspects. It's like if Shonda Rhimes called called all her series melodramatic fantasy so that people would cringe on every From the Dead Evil Twin Secret Identity cliffhanger. Anyway, the first time I recall someone going meta with it on live WWE TV was Chris Jericho's debut on Raw from Chicago, mocking WWE's downward spiral that was anything but. Thanks for your decades of dedication. I don't know if I buy the idea that sports entertainment is a term that Vince wants casual fans to use so they're not they're not embarrassed to be watching. Oh, it's not pro wrestling, it's sports entertainment, so it's okay that I watch this goofy stuff. I get what Brian's saying, and if that is in any way the case, Vince McMahon is fighting a battle from the like early 80s that's long over. Like, it's like, you know, when the Japanese fighters in Gilligan's Island were in the woods, like the jungle of wherever they were marooned and stranded. And they were still thought World War II was going on, and that was like a bit in Gilligan's Island. Like, if Vince is still fighting that battle with fans, it's like it's 40 years past.
Yeah, I mean, he's a $1 billion-a-year company, right? I mean, yeah. The TV deals that Nick Khan negotiated for him are incredible, and even though creatively they're mediocre at best, financially they're the most successful they've ever been.
Yeah. All right. Brad Tipton from Asheville, North Carolina says, the crowd reaction for Hangman tonight was much stronger than it's been in recent weeks, which is a pleasant surprise. Although it seems that as of late, everyone has been talking about how they need to get the title off Page because he seems stale and isn't connecting for a number of different reasons. However, I think the beginning of Page's disconnect was due to reasons that were beyond his control. I feel as if it is undoubtedly true that Page was most over and connected with fans as the beer-drinking badass channeling his inner Steve Austin. So could it be that the situation with Jon Moxley totally derailed the direction Hangman was heading with a badass beer-drinking character? Had the whole situation with Mox not happened, do you think he'd still ultimately end up exactly where he is now? Thanks for all your insight. So he's talking about Moxley going to alcohol rehab. Eric, what do you think about that theory?
No, I think it was actually better for Hangman Page because Danielson leaned into his heelness, and I don't know that Moxley could do anything to get booed. You know, pre-rehab, I don't think, you know, post-rehab, pre-rehab, I don't think Moxley could have done anything to get booed against Page. I mean, the Hangman Page just suffers by comparison to these people who are established WWE stars. Cole is a good worker, great worker, super charismatic, and Bryan Danielson is a generational talent, right? Just, you know, Mount Rushmore, greatest of all time discussion. And so, you know, you're using Danielson. They use Danielson to get Page over, right? They had a 60-minute draw that you and I loved and short attention span younger folks just couldn't deal with. And then he beat him, right? Beat him clean in two really good, great matches. And then he had a balls-to-the-wall, you know, match with Lance Archer. And then he beat Adam Cole. So it's like and the buy rates were good for him winning the title and him defending the title. So it's like, I get that he has a more subtle personality than the larger than life CM Punks and Bryan Danielsons of the world and the Jon Moxleys. But I would not call his reign a failure by any stretch. And it's, they're trying to get him over. That said, I would not, as big of a Hangman Page guy as I am, I would not complain one bit if MJF goes over Hangman Page in it All Out or potentially Double or Nothing and takes the title off him, right?
Yeah.
His story will have made sense. He will have established himself as a really good worker and a guy who drew on top, right? I know nobody really draws on top. It's an ensemble product, but ensemble promotion, but I do not consider, unlike many people, Hangman's reign so far to be a failure. I consider it to be a moderate success.
All right. Let's see. Up next, Shay from Brooklyn said, 2 weeks into the pay-per-view cycle, and they really have set up a lot of interesting new things. Now that Adam Page and the Four Pillars, Sammy, Darby, MJF, and Jungle Boy, all seem to be well-established, credible guys, they are starting on their own batch of even younger talent. Impressive night for Wheeler Yuta. Two separate crowd chants got me wanting to see him join up with Regal, Bryan, and Moxley. Also great to see Danny Garcia get spotlighted in some mic time during a segment with Jericho. These two guys development I really look forward to watching. I saw the Wardlow angle coming, but it played out better than I thought. The crowd seems firmly behind him and ready to erupt whenever Wardlow does get his hands on MJF. Ricky Starks and Powerhouse Hobbs are among my favorite duos. I think they play off each other really well, and more mic time for Ricky is always a blessing. The Page Cole face-off got a huge pop. The opening tag is a really fun way to start the show. This week felt like they didn't try to squeeze too much in. It was just enough of everything, and the pace was great. I love how AEW uses wrestlers' hometowns to get the most out of moments. They've done it over and over again. Solid show, top to bottom. I mean, in a way, I mean, I don't think we have to find the next four pillars constantly and always have it before. But if you know, and I think it's premature to say Wheeler Yuta's going to be that. But I mean, tonight makes you not crazy to suggest that might be the course he's on. Danny Garcia, Ricky Starks, Powerhouse Hobbs, Wheeler Yuta, are those like in a way the next four pillars or the next at least wave of, you know, call-ups from Dark who, and or Starks have just been, you know, mostly on commentary, but, you know, for to simplify things, sort of the four guys being elevated from where they had been, treading water a bit, are they a good four? And just specifically, what do you think about Ricky and Hobbs approaching Keith Lee, which we haven't talked about, and going, you know, here's another guy from over there coming in to take TV time away from us, and we're going to stop you?
I feel like Wheeler Yuta and Daniel Garcia need – you know, Daniel Garcia is still really young. I don't know how old Wheeler Yuta is, but they know they both need some charisma, right? I mean, they're good workers, could be great workers, but they need some interview or in-ring charisma to develop. Ricky Starks already has all that, and I think he's a pretty good worker. I for the life of me, I don't know why Ricky Starks hasn't gotten a bigger push. I assume it had something to do with his neck. I mean, and how much of that is because on the, you know, you can't tell what's real because it's a reality show, but the Roads to the Top show where they had that segment where was it Tony Khan telling Ricky Starks, hey, we got to take it easy, you have an injured neck. I can't remember what is the source of the injured neck from the Hangman suplex. It's the only thing holding Ricky Starks back, but Ricky Starks is great. And I laughed tonight because Keith Lee has this, if anybody needs, you know, a full minute or two to get themselves over in a promo, it's Keith Lee because he has that reserved way of speaking that's so non-stereotypical wrestler.
It's very interesting you would say that to me, Eric.
Yeah, and they just cut him off after one sentence, as happens to everybody in AEW all the time, right? They just get cut off in their promo. But it was – I thought the interrupting him was weird because – it would make sense to me if Keith Lee was wrestling either Hobbs or Ricky Starks on Rampage, but he's not. He's wrestling Max Caster. And so it's like, okay, you're continuing this feud, but you're not actually getting in the ring. And then I'm like, wow, they're really making Max Caster feel insignificant by not letting him talk. And then they had a segment with him later, which was great. But then Swerve Scott interrupts and Starks and Hobbs interrupt. It was just like, hey, let's pack five or six more guys into this, you know, 30-second, 1 minute backstage promo. And so by the end of it, I was thinking, well, Keith Lee needs a partner if he's going to take on Hobbs and Starks. You know, you could do the two singles matches, but, you know, you might want a tag team match in the mix there. And maybe it's Swerve Scott who gets to be Keith Lee's partner, right? Because he came to get in Ricky Starks' face. So, it's interesting. The four pillars thing, though, generally is a construct. And I get it because I was alive and watched All Japan Pro Wrestling thanks to Steve Sims giving me tapes, VHS tapes in the early 90s, right? So I know what they're talking about, but and saw those many of those matches. But I don't know, again, it's hardcore fans who know that stuff. Do AEW fans know in 2022? Do they know what happened in the 1990s?
Well, but it's sort of like the sports entertainer term being obnoxious even if you don't know the backstory. It's like you don't need to know anything about anything that happened before 2019 to understand there were four pillars in AEW and there might be a new four pillars that have come along since, which is the young guys who have been the identity of AEW who are AEW. It's sort of like TNA had the TNA originals. And that's kind of how I look at this. It's people without a track record of note prior to their prominence in this company. And there happen to be four of them that we have pinpointed. And now that they've established themselves, will there be another for the construct, the convenience of the construct? Can we grab four more names who can be the next four male pillars? People without a prior track record of note who are now getting utilized in a way where they seem like they're on the course to be every bit of a star as some of the acquisitions like Jay Lethal or Christian Cage who have had that or Keith Lee who have had that prior pushes of note elsewhere.
Yeah, I mean, I guess as constructs go, it's as good as any to try and help get people over, and I'm all for anything that gets younger talent over, right?
Yeah.
The next generation over.
Yeah, yeah. All right, David H. says, watching Dynamite tonight in the opening six-man tag match was all over the place. My seven-year-old out of nowhere says, wait, there was no tag, while multiple guys were in the ring. Smart seven-year-old. As the match progressed, illegal men in the ring only seemed to get worse. I know this has been a large issue with AEW during its entire existence, but I thought it was very interesting that a very young wrestling fan is able to point these things out, but it seems to just not matter to the AEW higher-ups. What, if any, thoughts do you have on this issue? Eric, I mean, I'd like there to be rules, and I'd like them to be followed, and I think the wrestlers who don't care about that would have more pride in their work, more reason for pride in their work, at least, if they worked within the structure of the rules. I think there's plenty of ways to fit in a lot of spots. It just takes a little more effort, a little more, savvy to figure out how to work your spots in a structure that doesn't make the referee look like an absolute buffoon. And if it means you have to edit out a few spots because it doesn't make any sense and you get disqualified because you can't come up with a creative way to fit them in, then so be it. There's plenty of other ways to be creative. So I am philosophically on Team Ross and Team 7-year-old daughter of David H.
Wade, when you were in school, if the teacher said at the beginning of class that he was going to give a pop quiz and then he forgot and there's 5 minutes left in class and you think you're going to skate because you haven't prepared, were you the type who raised their hand and said, teacher, teacher, we have a pop quiz, right?
No.
No? Okay. No. I get both sides of this argument. I think you either just go with it. I love the opening tag match. It was part of the stuff I like about AEW was just entertaining as hell. They did that triple moonsault spot that was, I loved it. I know it's not for everyone. It was very
a human fireworks show.
Choreographed and set up. Yeah. And then the part I laughed about was that the camera missed it the first time. So they had to go to replay with the wider shot.
You can't even blame Keith Mitchell anymore. He retired.
Yeah. I mean, I refer to this as the Young Bucks style of wrestling, like they made it widely popular. It's you're skipping the verses and everything is just the chorus, right? The part of the pop song that everybody likes. And it's like, the Young Bucks basically said, what if we just did high spots, the good stuff for the whole match? And I understand why there's but this was just, this was a hot opener, right? Time and a place for everything. I don't know that you want the no psychology, no selling matches as your main event, but I don't want to say this was a throwaway six man because it involved, the heavyweight champion and the tag team champions, but it was kind of a throwaway six man. And they've done that a lot. And, I think it's part of what put them on the map. It's part of their brand. And I relax about all of that stuff, but I understand why you wouldn't if you were an old school person. And it's that push and pull between the million fans you have and the next million that you want.
And it's also, what things that are old school are actually timeless, and it's simply people who lost sight of what the business is about who have made it seem old school. Like, just because, certain bookers have come along and played fast and loose with the fundamentals of what makes wrestling work as a genre doesn't mean it should be labeled as something that's passé and you're just, you're behind the times and stuck in the past if you don't. If you advocate for a return to that, like I disagree with that framing of it as old school, especially because there's plenty of people on AEW's roster who work what you just called old school because they think that is the way to sustain audience interest in an efficient execution of moves with selling and things you do between moves. That is the art of wrestling, and as important as the spots, and they see it as hack wrestling to just go, I'm just going to shove a bunch of junk food down fans' throats, as opposed to something that resembles having a cadence and a logic and a psychology and a beat to it that leads to ebbs and flows that work within the structure, the established structure of what is supposed to be an athletic contest, where you're not looking at it going, that was fun, but it made no sense afterwards. And that's eating a bag of Doritos and a bag of M&Ms, but it's not like high art when you do it. It works. I acknowledge that, but I don't think you just throw your hands up and say, well, now that it's done, you know, that's the way it ought to be. And I think there's a bunch of wrestlers in AEW who look at that stuff, including Cody, by the way, who's one of the issues. And Cody had his own faults, for sure, where it took away some of his high ground to stand on with some of the, you know, layer after layer of opulent interference and gratuitous layering of blood and whatever, all the other stuff he did. But anyway, my point is.
Yeah, Cody couldn't go. He did his own camouflage, right? And
yeah.
And I liked Cody's time in AEW, you know, except for the last few months when he was trying to fight the fan base.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's one of the beauties of AEW is you get, if you don't like that type of six-man match, then next coming up is Mox and Danielson to ground it again, right? You get lots of different things. And
I guess the issue is when you have all those things, does it work? Do they start working against each other? You know, when you have a pay-per-view where everything is booked for 4 hours, independent of anything else on the show, and then poor Hangman Page comes out and works, and Adam Cole, and they try to work a psychologically sound match with an ebb and a flow and a pacing, you have an exhausted crowd that's seen everything, and they've also seen a bunch of stuff like people getting up from much more devastating moves than anything Page and Cole have planned in their main event. Is that really serving the audience? Or are you just shoving, you know, soda pop, junk food, and Doritos into the mouths of kids as a way to placate them, but you're not actually serving them by doing that? And because they're just, by the end, they're just exhausted and they've broken the notion, the internal logic of wrestling in the pursuit of crowd pops and this is awesome chance. And I think that's a legit discussion to have. You can say, well, there's a little bit for everybody, and hey, variety is great, and hey, if you do this, then in the next match you do that. But I kind of like the idea that there's a vision at the top. And it might lead to some sacrifice, to some excitement and some spots and some pops. But I think the Bucks are fully capable of having every bit as exciting of a match if they do it with respect to the idea that everybody before them and a bunch of people right now in wrestling are finding a way to have really exciting matches in pop crowds while also respecting the damn structure of matches that every other generation has of great wrestlers have typically followed.
I mean, wrestling evolves, right? And so AEW is the great experiment in seeing if this sort of Young Bucks style of all chorus, no versus, which is an oversimplification, but it's a shorthand, whether that works. Is that going to be the thing that kicks it to the next level, or is it not because it's junk food and ultimately unsustainable? You know, I mean, I would hate for, you know, AEW is an ensemble show. So for them to go to this sort of WWE style, everybody on the undercard has to sort of take it easy so that the main event doesn't get overshadowed. You know, Hulk Hogan being resentful because Steamboat and Savage ate he and Andre's lunch at WrestleMania at the Silverdome. You know, that would kill the very essence of AEW. Like, if everything is dumbed down and boring so that the main event could be, they'd have to switch their whole way of doing business because, as you pointed out a number of times, the world title belt is not that significant in AEW and never really has been, right? I mean,
that is not, you know, sometimes they say that's a feature, not a flaw. That is a flaw, not a feature. You know, you can have an ensemble company more than WWE is with Roman Reigns or Brock Lesnar. But you also, I don't think there's ever a circumstance where having a world title that doesn't feel like, you know, Todd Martin talks about this all the time. Wrestlers should be talking about that world title more often, even when they're not in the vicinity of a title shot. I want to remember what I wanted to push back on before you said that. And at this deep into a show, I should take notes because I can lose my train of thought. Dumbing down and slowing down the undercard. That is a straw man argument and definitely not what I'm advocating for. And I want to be clear. I am not saying make the undercard boring so that the main eventers, the fans are so bored, they're just ready to pop for anything. And I know I'm now dumbing down your argument even more than you know, is fair. But to me, it's not about that. It's about making sure that there isn't a move that someone pops up from earlier on the card in order to then do another move quickly so they can get a self-indulgent this is awesome chant when your main eventers are going to do that move and it's meant to be a dramatic near fall, if not the finish. In other words, it's keeping an eye on what you're doing in the first hour that does set the stage for what happens in the third or fourth hour. And, I mean, I was backstage at a Windy City Wrestling show. Paul Heyman was booking it circa 89-90, and like in between every match where I was shooting photos, I went backstage and Paul was explaining to me, this is why I'm doing this. This is what I learned from watching this territory, studying this promoter. And that, if you'll notice in that match, this referee did this in response to something. I'm going to be revisiting that in the main event later so that I've conditioned the fans to understand that what happened in that first match is establishing what the rules are for when it happens later, when somebody gets in trouble, and then the fans will know that there's more risk. There's some jeopardy there. So it was like, he put thought into everything that happened in the first few matches, and he used it as a way to set up what would happen in the last match or later in the show. So it didn't mean he didn't want the matches to be exciting. It's just he didn't want them to be exciting at the unnecessary, inefficient expense of doing something logical and undercutting the impact that it would have later.
Yeah, and AEW is definitely not set up that way, right? It's
no.
Tony Khan decides who is married to who, and then it seems like for the most part, the performers all get to fill in the blanks from there, right? For,
yes.
You know, and
you can hit the scramble button. What's the button where it randomly sorts songs on an album?
Shuffle.
That's where I knew it wasn't scramble. Shuffle. He hits the you could hit the shuffle button on his pay-per-views. Like, I mean, there wouldn't be a storyline deficiency. It wouldn't be break. You know, like art, like musicians put their songs in a certain order for different reasons, but part of it is sort of the in-concert song playlist too. There's a certain ebb and a flow and a reason that they put songs in the order that they do. In AEW, I mean, I'm sure that's done some of the time. But I think Tony thinks, well, how do I put an exciting match that'll wake up the crowd at the beginning? And I think he puts thought into match order. But by the time the pay-per-views are over, I'm not sure that they would be any worse if you hit shuffle and rewatched it almost randomly. Part of that is the parity and the depth of the roster and how hard all the wrestlers work, and that's a good thing. But it also shows there's a lack of attention paid to, is something we're doing on the first half going to undercut what we're trying to do on the second half?
Yeah, I think that's in part because everybody gets to play their own music in AEW.
Yeah.
And then to your story about Paul Heyman in Chicago in the late 80s, early 90s, trying to book a Windy City Wrestling show, AEW, for as big of a company as it is, still seems to sort of run on a bare bones operation. And you and Todd have talked about on The Fix numerous times about how there's no quality control person. QT Marshall may format the TV based on what he's given in terms of time, but there's nobody who seems to be looking at, okay, if we do this spot or we do this angle in segment one, are we repeating the same thing in segment four and segment seven? I mean, I had a problem with a lot of last week's TV show because, you know, the FTR Tully split came out of nowhere. Why is Adam Cole get a rematch when he lost clean and there was no explanation for it? You know, they repeat stuff in the show. You know, there are now two stables disintegrating at once, Inner Circle and the Pinnacle. And then there's two beatdowns, you know, post match, and there's just repetition of style and choices. And I think if you had that quality control person that you and Todd have talked about, somebody looking at the big picture, then they could tweak a segment here and there, so you don't get that sort of repetition that feels you know, a little unsatisfying.
Absolutely. All right, Chris from Truth or Consequences, New Mexico says, "Okay, I was so excited to see the Hardys wrestle in AEW. I've been waiting for what seems like an eternity. With that being said, man, they look slow and old. That match kind of broke my heart. Please talk me off the ledge." Well, Eric, I mean, they are slower and older. Matt Hardy wearing a T-shirt and trying to act like one half of a really athletic tag team is a real stretch right now. And that's why I go, you know, that's why I'm thinking the trouble. Now, Eric, pop quiz. How old do you, speaking of pop quizzes, how old do you think Jeff Hardy is?
42?
Yeah, 44. And Matt's 47. 4 years younger than Jericho, but Jericho just got himself into pristine shape. And, you know, Hardy, you know, for Matt, I mean, it's like time to, you know, lay off anything that adds extra body weight and get in shape if you want to have a respectable nostalgia tour. Hardy is the old guy taking advantage of young talent to siphon off the top their hard-earned money while you're pretending to serve their interest. Well, that's fine. Then you can, you know, have a gut and wear a T-shirt and all that. But if you want to have a respectable nostalgia tour, it's kind of like, you know, time to you know, time to get your ass into gear and get up a little earlier and do the cardio and cut out the empty calories and try to like have an athletic, not jump out the way that Matt probably will in this context. I have no problem with Matt at 47 doing what he's been doing in terms of his physical appearance. It fit the gimmick. He is now doing a nostalgia gimmick where you kind of want to still look the part, and that could work against him. I didn't get jumped out tonight as bad as it did for Chris, but I think Chris had higher expectations than I did, so that probably played into it.
Yeah, I mean, they probably get away with it in other promotions where the work rate isn't sort of – the bar isn't so high, right?
Yeah.
I mean, can't we just give this to Matt Hardy? He needs this paycheck. I mean, he keeps popping out kids at a rate of one a year, I think, maybe even two every 19 months for a while there. And so the guy needs a paycheck. He's got a young family to feed. No, seriously, we talked about this earlier in the show. Private Party created the movement tonight, and that's to be expected, and that's to be encouraged. And every tag team they face all want to face the Hardys, and they will do their best to help the Hardys stay over. So to talk you down from the ledge, Chris from Truth or Consequences, New Mexico, Mick Foley's, where he was billed, I think, first. Cactus Jack. I think it'll be fine because everybody wants to make the Hardys look good because for them it's all their dream match from when they were kids. They get to live out childhood fantasies.
And you know, I remember Honky Tonk Man telling me 15 years ago, as long as I can look like Honky Tonk Man when I come to the ring, I can make money on the indie scene. I'll just keep, dyeing my hair black and fitting in a jumpsuit.
And he never worked at all, even when he was in WWE.
Yeah.
So.
Well, that's where I'm leading. For Honky Tonk Man, he just had to look the part. Jeff Hardy can look the part, but people want him to hit the swanton without worrying about him breaking his neck. And they want to see him be able to take the bumps and build that Ricky Morton sympathy. And so the pressure's a little higher on him than even Matt. Matt was the architect of the matches behind the scenes. I was reporting on that in the early 2000s, like when no one knew what the difference between Matt and Jeff. I'm like, oh yeah, Matt's the guy who's backstage talking while Jeff is has headphones on or is somewhere else mentally. Matt's the one mapping out the matches. He's the architect, and then Jeff goes out there and gets all the girls to scream and hits the high spots. And so Matt has less pressure, but he's still there's a certain bar he has to hit. But Jeff's the one, where at 44 is this gimmick sustainable? Honky Tonk Man had a sustainable gimmick if he just looked the part.
Yeah. I mean, but, what does this have to last? 2 years at the longest? Yeah.
6 months. 6 months is what I'm giving it, and then they'll go in a different direction. But you know what? I mean, we've seen people – how old's Bryan Danielson now?
39, 40?
He's older than that. That's why I want to look it up. Yeah, 4. Okay, 40. So he is what you just said. So Jeff Hardy's only 4 years older than Bryan Danielson. I mean, Bryan had years off, but a lot of wear and tear. Jeff's had a lot of wear and tear. I think Jeff can go longer than 6 months, but I think the Hardy Boy Nostalgia Act, having dream tag team matches, maybe they wrap that up come, All Out. And then you figure out what you're going to do next. Matt reinvents himself, just not necessarily at the main event level like Jericho, but he's the king of reinventing too. And then, Jeff can have the nostalgia run with Matt, but then I think you go to some, singles dream matches later in the year. Depending on how he holds up and, how crowds keep reacting to him.
Tony Khan has a vested interest in Jeff Hardy, getting his money's worth out of Jeff Hardy, who I'm sure didn't come cheap. And the Young Bucks probably, they've always looked up to the Hardys, modeled themselves after. So they've got some stroke there, and they can continue to advocate for the Hardys push.
For sure. All right, cool. Eric, anything else from the show in your notes we didn't get to?
I'm so woozy at this point, even if there is, yes. I'm going to take a pass.
No, I understand. I understand. My night's just getting started. I got Keller Hotline to record and podcast to edit, but I don't have to get up in the morning. The usual time that most people do. So, thank you, Eric. Great having you on. Good talking AEW for a very long time here. Very much appreciate it.
Thanks, Wade.
Yep. Thanks to our listeners, and we'll talk to you next time.